Production. Recorded live.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to episode 35 of the Wrestling Culture Podcast. Dave Musgrave and Dylan Hales here, joined by our good friends Will and Charles, or as I like to call them, Goodwill Hunting and Charles in Charge.
Excellent. That's far better than that. Actually, might even be better than Charles X. Actually, now that I think about it, I'm kind of jealous I didn't think of that.
You had to go through my campaign slogan when I ran for junior high class president.
What was it? Was it literally Charles in Charge?
It was. Yeah, I actually campaigned on that. The Charles in Charge was my motto.
That is awesome. God, that's great. Did you have your face superimposed over the body of Scott Baio on the campaign literature?
No. I don't know if I was just afraid that someone might make Scott Gayo jokes or what.
Oh, man. Actually, if you've ever seen them with their shirts off, not to be the gay one here, but Willie Ames clearly had the better body, dude. Come on.
I think Nicole Eggert had the best body of anybody on that show. But
to bring the manliness back to the show real quick. Good job.
I'm probably actually the least masculine person on the phone, so I don't know about that. But anyhow, we have been waiting.
No debate there. Anyone want to pitch in? Sorry.
Yes, we've been waiting to get you gentlemen back on for a while, partially because Dave and I are screw-ups and partially because our schedules haven't worked so well in conjunction with each other. In any event, originally we had thought about doing another show on one of the yearbook sets, but instead we have the entire pro wrestling-only moderating team and Wrestling Observer newsletter contributor and voter Dave Musgrave on the line today to discuss a roundtable discussion on Terry Funk, Ric Flair, and Jerry Lawler. And I think before we even go any farther, and then I'm going to kind of let Dave set the table if he wants to, but I just want to throw this out here. I don't want this to be a negative show. I know probably everybody else on the line agrees with that. This isn't going to be a lot of Ric Flair sucked because, or Terry Funk sucked because, or Jerry Lawler sucked because, or either one was worse than the other because of X. It's going to be these guys, this guy was better than the others because of X. Or at least that's going to be how I'm going to try and frame it.
Dylan, can I interrupt you for one moment? You clearly don't know me very well. Okay, because I am spitting venom tonight, man. I'm like, Terry Funk, garbage wrestler. Ric Flair does the same shit every match. I'm throwing out venom.
But in all seriousness, I think all three of us would agree that those are probably on the short list of the three greatest wrestlers of all time. There might be a little bit of more disagreement on Terry Funk. I'm not sure. We'll get to that. If I know, probably would agree with that statement as well. But Dave has decided to play moderator for the purposes of this show because I think Charles and Will and I all probably would rate those three guys in a slightly different order. I think I could be wrong on that. I think when we flesh it out, we're all going to have a depth chart that's slightly different. So,
Dylan, can we just start with the depth chart? Like, for those three guys, not including anyone else, like, outside the box, but just for those three guys, how would you rate them? Seriously.
If you ask me right this second if I was forced to do, like, if we were doing a greatest wrestler of all time poll again, which has been done online before, I would probably go Funk 1, Lawler 2, Flair 3. That would not necessarily be my overall top three, I should note. Although those would be my top three American wrestlers, for sure. Those would be my top. I don't think there's any question about those being my top three American wrestlers. So maybe the only other possible guy I would even consider, believe it or not, would be Rey Mysterio, who I think is a clear peg down. But as far as guys known for American wrestlers, those would be my top three, and they would be in that order. Will, how about you?
Me? Well, my, as I watch more footage and as I make these sets and participate in the yearbooks and the 80s projects, I'm going Lawler number one, Flair two, Funk three. And I think I'm firm on that right now.
Okay, Charles?
I would go Flair number one, Lawler number two, and Funk number three.
Okay, and Dave, even though you've positioned yourself as the agnostic quasi-moderator for the purpose of this, off the cuff, would you lean one way or the other?
Well, we've done a show before where I basically came out to say Funk at that point. It would be hard for me between Funk and Flair, but I'd probably go Funk, Flair, Lawler.
Okay, so actually, yes, we all have slightly, all four of us at this moment would have different pairing. Let's get this out of the way then, too. Would we all characterize those guys as absolute upper-tier people? And by that I mean, if you were to do an all-time list, would all three of those guys appear and say, we'll say your top 15?
Easily.
Absolutely.
Yes. I had to think about it for a second, but yes.
Yeah, because I know Charles is slightly lower on Terry Funk than I am, and probably than a lot of people are, although maybe not more than consensus. I don't know, because I'm not entirely sure what the consensus on Funk is relative to other people. But, again, we'll get to that point. Dave, I'm gonna allow you to throw a question if you have out to the panel, or a thought if you have out to the rest of us, and then we can play off of that.
Okay. Well, I thought we'd start off first with domestic policy in terms of how each guy was in their own territory.
I was like, wait a minute, abortion? What?
Yeah, well, if we're talking abortions, we have to. Assume
I'm sure Lawler's got a few of those under his cuff.
Yeah. Well, I think Lawler would be the one with the most abortions by teenagers, but I just threw that out there.
This
guy had a heart attack.
I was going to say, we know that Lawler sells a heart attack better than Flair, too.
Oh, man, we're staying
hey, if you guys had fans before this show, they're gone now, dude. Your fucking Observer Hall of Fame shit is revoked. You're now part of WrestleCrap lore. You're done, man.
I will say this, in defense of Jerry Lawler, he probably, you know, Ric Flair tried to charge for prom dates, and Lawler probably did it for free.
Oh, God.
This is going to be the tone of the discussion. God.
On this metric, I have to agree that Funk would be the odd man out. See, already you guys are convincing me. Because on this metric, I think he's probably the odd man out. But
Hold on. I know Funk has a bunch of daughters, right? Like, no sons. So I'm going to venture to say that Lawler and Flair always like to book themselves against Funk because he was bringing his daughters on the road. Just had to get that out there. We're done.
Okay. Now, Dave, by domestic policy, did you mean literally their individual home territories?
Sure.
Okay. Boy, that's...
I think there's a pretty easy winner on that one, honestly.
I mean, yeah. Well, you know what? I'm gonna let the person who I think we assume would be the easy winner, and the person lobby. Will, you answer this question. You go first.
If you're looking at home territory, so we're going to guess, okay, well, Dylan, just so I get this right, I'm going to say that Terry Funk's home territory would be all Japan. Would you dispute that? Because, I mean, we don't have Amarillo footage.
Well,
we don't know.
We don't have Amarillo. I think, you know, for the purposes of this discussion, you would have to treat all Japan as the closest thing he had to a home territory. Yeah.
Right. Okay,
but
you don't want to
handicap him in the foreign policy category when that comes up.
That's right.
That's true, but I'll get to that, because there's a broader argument for Funk that transcends any of this, which is kind of my argument for him as the all-time guy anyway, and I'll get to that whenever it comes up.
Okay.
But for the interim, let's go to Lawler or Memphis.
Well, clearly no one meant more to a single territory than Lawler did to Memphis. Even Flair, as NWA touring champ, you know, he made Charlotte his home base or whatever. But, and to his credit, he was popular all over. And as NWA touring champ, really, I mean, sometimes St. Louis was his base. Sometimes, you know, he was wrestling in the Omni. He was doing the Georgia territory for a little while. But Lawler had to go to Memphis, wrestle scrubs, and admittedly, some great wrestlers, week in, week out. And he was more successful than anyone in that territory doing it. And probably meant more to his company in terms of great matches, in terms of drawing, in terms of what he meant to the community than any other wrestler, you know, including one of my favorites, Buddy Rose, who probably was close to that in Portland. And I don't think anyone else is close.
Yeah. Go ahead, Charles.
I was just going to say, I agree that Lawler was in this category, but at the same time, I don't think you can discount how much Ric Flair meant in the Mid-Atlantic territory and how much he meant to Crockett when he was going national. So if you're looking at that as his home territory, yes, I think Lawler still comes out ahead, because had Lawler left Memphis, I mean, the territory would have collapsed. But at the same time, I think you also have to give Flair credit for his role with Jim Crockett and even with Mid-Atlantic before the expansion, because he was a pretty valuable player there too. So I just wanted to get that out there.
Yeah, and just to kind of to emphasize, when Lawler lost the Loser Leaves Town match in 85, the territory did collapse.
Yep.
You know, so it did. It went into the tank and probably never fully recovered ever after that. But
no, I actually would say that Lawler, you know, when he was hurt, when he broke his leg and Jimmy Hart came in, they sort of used Jimmy Hart as the guy. This was, I guess, in 80. They sort of used him as the guy who you ran the territory through. It was a brilliant decision because it was clearly the best decision. It was the best thing they could do at the time. And it worked, I think, better than they could have expected. But I actually think attendance did dip some at that point as well. And it really didn't heat fully back up until Lawler came back from his injury. So even then, when you had Jimmy Hart probably at the all-time peak of his skills as a manager, you know, when he was Jimmy Hart's probably no worse than the second-best manager of all time. At his peak, anyway. And,
Jameson, of course.
Frenchie Martin's number one. But he, you know, at that point, I think you kind of, even in that era, when theoretically it was before the territories were collapsing, like it was in 85, where you could maybe make the argument, well, the landscape had changed. The landscape hadn't changed in 80, and the loss of Lawler still kind of hurt. I think, from that perspective, Lawler certainly meant more. If we're treating all Japan as Funk's home territory, which for all practical purposes is probably the best choice, although I don't really think he has a home territory, and I think in a way that's a plus for him. But the one thing that always sticks out to me with Funk and all Japan is there were not Gaijin babyfaces really before Terry Funk. And Terry Funk in all Japan, I think, is maybe the best babyface I've ever seen. I mean, if somebody wanted to make an argument for Ricky Morton, I wouldn't really, you know, scream or cry about it. If somebody wanted to make an argument for Ricky Steamboat, I wouldn't fuss about it. But in terms of being able to combine both the vulnerability and the selling that you need to get heat and timing and comebacks and really pushing things to a different level offensively as well, and being able to look credible against giants and small guys and everybody in between, the connection he had with the audiences in All Japan is actually unbelievable to watch even now, even after we're used to American wrestlers getting cheers there. But at the time, when he first really became a babyface icon over there, that was unheard of. I mean, it wasn't something that just anybody could have done. To that end, I find it unbelievably impressive because I don't think you can find any American wrestler, even now, years and years later, who has ever been as over as a babyface in Japan as Terry Funk. In fact, I don't think anybody's even been close. And we're talking 60 years of wrestling in Japan on a high level, you know, 60, 70 years, and he's the only guy that's even close to that level. There's nobody even in the universe. So while I would hesitate a little bit to call All Japan a home promotion, I do agree with Will that for the purposes of this discussion, it's probably his home promotion. And I think he has an interesting case because he did something that nobody had ever done before. And even now, it still stands out as a utterly unique phenomenon.
Hmm.
I mean, does anybody disagree with that?
He could be argued as the best babyface of all time as far as his All Japan work goes. You could also argue that for Lawler in Memphis, even though he had a lot of heel runs there as well, but in terms of just being such a focal point of that territory.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think Lawler was an outstanding babyface, but Lawler also got the direct rub from Jackie Fargo and was sort of – Lawler was handed a role that already existed. Now, obviously, he took it to a totally different level. I don't think there's any question about that. But Funk created a role that previously didn't exist. And that would be kind of my argument for him within the confines of this. That doesn't mean that he's a better ace of a promotion than Lawler. I don't think that's true at all. But it does mean that his case is, I think, maybe distinct in a way that the other two – I mean, I don't want to say it's normal because they're both Lawler and Flair are distinct themselves. But with Funk, I think it's especially distinct because you can't point to anything like that. There's no – I can't think of anything else like it anyway.
Well,
I mean,
Dylan, can you confirm this for me? You would know this better than I do. Was Ric Flair part of the first wave of single stars in Mid-Atlantic? You know, it was a tag team territory until, what, the mid-70s? Is that right?
The first guys that were really pushed, and you're right, it was basically a tag team territory into the mid-70s. You know, the first guys that were really put, my understanding is, were Johnny Valentine and Don Jardine and Walter McDaniel were the absolute first wave of guys. And Flair basically came in right, it might have been right after or right at the same time, but he's usually not cited as the guy that did it, but he is cited in that group of guys, if you know what I mean. Like, there was about four or five names you usually see, and Flair's one of them, along with Valentine, Wahoo, and actually Don Jardine, believe it or not, which he kind of gets lost in the shuffle. But those are the guys that you'll use. Like, if you talk to somebody who's big on Mid-Atlantic history, those usually are the names you hear when it comes to the shift from a tag team territory to a singles territory. And that's a fair point in Flair's favor, too, by the way. A very fair point. And I think Flair took it to the next level, too, because while all those guys were stars, Flair was the transcendent star of that bunch, and I don't think there's any arguing against that. You know, he became the personification of Mid-Atlantic wrestling. Absolutely.
Right.
And while those other guys may have become single stars there when it was a tag team division, Flair became the single star there eventually. And none of those other guys did. You know, maybe you could argue there was a brief period where Johnny Valentine was or where Wahoo was, but never to the extent that Flair was.
And I think that's also because we live in the video age and, you know, what we see on tape. Well, a lot of that, we just don't know how they were taken. Because to me, I always felt like there was something special about Wahoo. Like, this guy, because when we saw him in the 80s, he was already on his way out. You know, he was on the downside of his peak of his career. But Wahoo always felt special. Like, when you see Wahoo on TV, when you see him in a big match, when you hear him in an interview, you always felt there's something special about this guy. There's something captivating. And Flair has the same quality, and Lawler does too, and Funk as well. You know, I'm just saying that out of those guys you mentioned, he's the one that kind of, like, I could see be because of, I'll say it, I don't care. I think, you know, a lot of wrestling fans like their ethnic baby faces. Or if they didn't, the promoters wouldn't run them so much, really, right? I mean, you know,
yeah,
and they made money. And I see Wahoo as being kind of like one of those guys that really work out. And I know Wahoo also had his heel runs, too. I'm just saying, he seems like maybe the one guy out of that whole bunch that you listed, Dylan, that might have at his peak, you know, had that special quality. You know, we have to come see this guy, you know.
Yeah, I think that's a fair point. I wouldn't disagree with that. I you know, and those they're growing up where I did grow up in the Mid-Atlantic region, though, you talk to the old-timers and, you know, both old-timer fans and people like Mike Mooneyham, who lives in town and is a reporter and knows all these guys.
Sure.
And I can tell you right now, the names that stand out, the names you'll always hear in this area are Johnny Weaver, George Becker, Rip Hawkins, Sweet Hansen, the Scott brothers, the Andersons. Almost all those guys are tag team specialists.
Yeah.
And then you hear Wahoo, Johnny Valentine, and Ric Flair, and especially Ric Flair. Like, there, and it's not just guys my age who would put Ric Flair, like, above the other guys. You know what I mean? Like, everybody. Guys that are 65 years old would tell you the same thing. So, Flair is, I think it is fair to say, is a cut above the rest within Mid-Atlantic lore. I don't think it's really, I don't think there's a big argument against that.
No.
I don't see anybody who would really be even close enough to make it a serious race.
And, Dylan, that's actually a really good segue for a point that I wanted to make about Flair. And I'm going to bring it up now just because I'm not sure where it really fits into the rest of the conversation. But there is a contingency that's always supported Flair, that's always seen it as just something that you don't question. You know, you have the Ric Flair support that comes from people who just consider him the greatest of all time because he's the champ, because he's the man, because he's the best of all time. So I guess I kind of want to clarify before we get too far into this that that's not really where I'm coming from with this.
Mm-hmm.
So because to me, I sometimes get frustrated with that line of thinking, and I'm talking about like your Bruce Mitchell types, even Dave Meltzer, because I think it discourages people from, like, it sets up like this wall of defense against Flair that sometimes he has to overcome, which I wish he didn't have to. You know, when people talk, you know, about something like the Flair Steamboat series, which I'm sure we'll talk about, being the greatest of all time, but not really talking about what it was that made it the best of all time, or just elaborating on it, and you're just, you know, you're kind of stupid if you don't just see it for yourself. I have a problem with that, you know. So I actually think they do a disservice to Flair's legacy in some ways, especially with people who are newer to liking pro wrestling in a completely obsessive way like we do, because they're not coming in with those preconceived notions of Flair, but they're being given them without any explanation.
Hey, guys, let me jump in there, because that's a great point on Flair, and I agree with everything Charles just said. But I also want to say that, you know, for someone like Jerry Lawler, he's had to combat this notion that Memphis is a joke territory, that it's not serious wrestling, that you know, that he's a comedy character, and that Memphis is a comedy town. I mean, Bret Hart writes in his book, "Fucking Canadians." You know what I mean? Like, it's right there that, you know, it was a joke territory, and Bret went there to have. Yeah, that was a dig at you, Dave. I'm sorry, but but then
I got
you know
back.
But for a lot of people who didn't see Funk in his prime, or maybe haven't even seen the footage of his prime, for them he's a crazy old man garbage wrestler, and we know that's not true. But, you know, I think that perception of him hurts him when, you know, evaluating him as one of the greatest of all time. You know, and I think I agree with what Charles said about Flair, but I also think that each of the guys that we're talking about has an obstacle to overcome when people evaluate their careers.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I don't disagree with that. I will say that I think Flair has the biggest benefit and the biggest negative when it comes to perception. He has the biggest benefit because I think the starting point, you know, with everything, there's sort of a starting point. Like, if you're analyzing any particular sport or any entertainment medium, there's always like one guy or one movie or one figure that is generally the accepted number one, the default number one that you have to prove everything against. And
Michael Jordan.
There you go. That's a good one. And that's kind of how Flair is. And I think that's a negative and a positive for him. I mean, it's a negative because of the things Charles just mentioned. You know, it becomes like this sort of innate thing that only a fool couldn't understand, and it really stifles debate, and it really cheapens the discussion of Flair's career. It's a good thing because if you start off at number one, you know, people are constantly chasing, playing catch up in the discussion, in the debate. I mean, when we did the last greatest of all time poll, when 50 of us voted back in 2005 or 2006, whenever it was,
yep.
Flair was my number one and Funk was my number two. I have subsequently flipped, although I don't think there's a huge gap between them. But I subsequently flipped. But the point is, even then, even within the last few years, Flair was my default number one. So I think for a lot of people, that's sort of the default place for him. Lawler is weird because Lawler is kind of the opposite in that when I first started talking to people online, which was a long time ago, there were a handful of us that were huge Memphis wrestling fans, and we were the overwhelming minority when it came to – like people. A lot of people liked the storylines, about the angles, thought the show was funny and entertaining and different and cool, but nobody thought Jerry Lawler was an all-time great wrestler outside of me and Phil Schneider and, like, five other people. I mean, there was no consensus view, and even then – I would have had him much lower than I had him now. I think I had him 15, for example, in that poll. Now that seems ludicrously low. You know, in hindsight, that seems like a crazy low position for Jerry Lawler. I mean, it's kind of a weird dynamic in terms of perception with all three, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I think when you know, right now, a lot of people, I don't want to be like some people and obsess over trends, but at the same time, I think when revisionism is a big thing right now, and it has been for the last few years, no one wants to say that Ric Flair is the best of all time because it's too easy.
Yeah, I think that's a fair point.
Yeah.
I don't agree with that.
You know, I'm actually in the middle there, Charles. Oh, I'm sorry.
You're showing yourself you're smart by knocking him down a peg. I've actually seen the argument out there that the reason he's hyped as the number one of all time is just because of Meltzer, which I think people who never heard of Meltzer came up with that on their own, too. So.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, Charles, I'm actually right in the middle because when I got online, when I started looking at footage, I saw all the great Flair matches, the Steamboat matches, the Four Horsemen matches. You know, I made the 41-disc Four Horsemen. You know, had to get a quick plug in. Had to do this stuff. But, you know, mentally, you know, when that Greatest of All Time poll came out, I was kind of done with Flair. Like, you know, another Ric Flair match. I don't want to see him. And then over at the DVR Death Valley Driver Board, we started doing the 80s projects. When you're forced to watch the matches, and we haven't even done Crockett or Mid-Atlantic yet, but when you're forced to watch Flair matches from All Japan, Memphis, Mid-South, you know, Texas, and even AWA now, it's like, wait a minute. You know, a lot of the criticisms levied at Flair, you know, yeah, of course, all these criticisms levied at him, they're not really true. It's like Flair might have some signature spots, but he doesn't do them the same way, the same time in every match. It's not like it's a robot going out there dancing or whatever. It's a fucking organic match, and there are Flair matches I like and Flair matches I don't like from those sets, but I grew to love Ric Flair a second time, you know. I got him out of my system first, and then I started to fall in love with him all over again, to be sentimental, you know. So Flair actually kind of dropped from number one, you know, de facto, and then actually built himself up all over again with this 80s project, you know, seeing the footage, man, opening your eyes, you know, really did, so.
I actually think once the 80s project is done, a Flair 150 would be pretty fun to do.
Yeah, actually, a Flair 150, and you could easily do that. I mean, in fact, I'm going to take the opportunity to steal this position for a second and for this question out, because I think that's one area where I think generally Lawler is the best ace in terms of home territory. I kind of agree with the takeaway on that. But I think in terms of volume, like if you're looking at volume, output, whatever term you want to use, total quantity of both good matches and great matches, I could see an argument for Lawler because he's got a lot out there, you know, and his career, he's been better for longer, in my opinion, than Flair, which we'll get to, I'm sure. But
I think Flair, in terms of what we have available against variety of opponents at his absolute peak, is, I would say, probably the number one guy in wrestling history. Now, I say that with one minor caveat, and the guy's name who I'm going to mention is maybe going to be surprising. The one qualifier I might say is Rey Mysterio Jr., who's had pretty much the guy you could throw on TV any time over the last 15 years with anybody, and he's going to have a good match. But Flair probably has more great matches than Rey, if you want to use that as a tiebreaker.
Hold on. Let me add a little disclaimer, a little footnote at the bottom there. That have been televised. Because
yeah,
Flair
yeah.
has the unique advantage, because he's so popular, and this is to his credit, that every territory he went, his matches were recorded for eternity. And so you have the matches preserved in Mid-South, in Texas, you know, whereas, like, we don't have, I mean, it was kind of a frustrating thing putting Memphis together. We don't always get week-to-week Jerry Lawler preserved.
No,
you know, we get
true.
Clips, we get snippets, and you wish. But I think Flair benefits, in that case, from the volume, because Schwab's tape in his matches preserved his matches.
No, that's true. And to add on to that a little bit, the guy who loses the most is Funk, and it's not close. Because Funk, we arguably don't even have his athletic prime at all on tape. I mean, we are very, very little. I mean, we have snippets, on Will's Terry Funk set that he plugged. There is, a clip of a Chavo Guerrero match, for example, from L.A. that looks outstanding, the 3 or 4 minutes that are there. But it's barely a fragment of a match, you know. And we don't have any Amarillo. We don't have really hardly any of his AWA title run at all, you know, other than little snips here and there and the actual title loss to Harley Race in Toronto. There's very little of what would actually be the athletic prime of Terry Funk that exists on tape. So
right. From
that perspective, I think the guy who probably is handicapped, in fact, I really don't even see an argument for the other two, is Funk, because at least
Agreed. We
have some Lawler in his prime, and we certainly have Flair's prime. We probably don't even have prime Terry Funk, I mean, athletically anyway. So anyway, Charles, I know you like to talk about Flair's versatility with a variety of wrestlers and the amount of good matches he had. So I want you to speak on that some.
Sure. Well, and also I'll just say about Terry Funk, because I want to praise Terry Funk also. The I would say that the Jumbo match from 76 is probably better than, honestly, any Ric Flair match. And I think that's a pretty big statement coming from me, but I mean it. So, I mean, the Funk Jumbo is probably, in terms of complete matches I've seen from the 70s, I don't see anything else that is as good as that. But talking about Flair and his longevity, I guess what I look at is his peak, and this is where, this to me is the battleground for the argument, is how long was Ric Flair at his best? And not just how long was Ric Flair good? Because I think if you're asking the question, how long is Ric Flair good, you're looking at, I mean, I would say until maybe 95, 96, I mean, he could have good matches regularly. So he was good that long. But if you're looking at, like, the number of years where he was probably either the best in the world or in the conversation, I think it's about 8 years. I think if you look from 1982 to 1989, he's either going to be the number one pick or close enough to the number one pick that no one would dispute it every one of those years. My favorite stretch to talk about with Ric Flair for talking about Flair's great matches is actually a little stretch in April and May of 1985. And it's fragmented, you know, because the 80s project sets are kind of, they're released by territory, but I think when you combine it all into one, like, cohesive story, it tells it something interesting, because...
Like a yearbook, Charles?
Yeah. Maybe one ever thought of something like that. But if you look at it, like, there are, and some of these matches didn't even actually make the 80s DVDs, I still think they're good, but they just didn't quite make the set. But, like, Flair on April 23rd of 1985 was facing Choshu, and the next night he was against Jumbo. 3 nights later, he was against Kerry Von Erich, which made the set, the Mid-South set. The next night, he was against Terry Taylor, in Mid-South in another great match that made this set. A few days later, he was against Terry Taylor in Houston, which was a great match that made this set. A couple of days later, he was against Kevin Von Erich in Dallas, which made this set. So I guess I just saw that as kind of a microcosm of how I picture Ric Flair to have been for 8 years, where maybe he's not having, like, you know, I think it's ridiculous to say he was having a match of the year candidate every single night, but I also think there's something to the fact that, I mean, if he was working, you know, 5 or 6 competitive matches a week, that probably 4 to 5 of them were very good, you know, and I think when you look at, you know, some of the periods where we do have a lot of back-to-back footage of him going from place to place in like a 2 or 3 week period, the evidence is there.
Well, I'm not going to dispute it. I mean, I'm not going to dispute that at all. I think the best argument for Flair in the debate like this, or if you even want to call it a round table like this, is volume. I think that's the best. I don't think it's the only argument for him, but I think volume during peak years, if that's the way you want to break it down even more specifically, which I think is kind of your point, Charles, I think that is the best argument for Flair as the best wrestler of all time and as the best of these three. Having said that, I do want to give Will a chance to talk about Lawler's volume, because I think Lawler's volume is underrated. I think it's very underrated. And as the representative of Lawler, I'm going to let you talk about that rather than me.
Well, yeah, because I was going to interrupt you if you didn't let me, man, because I'm, and this is actually something I think I've talked to you all individually about. If you want to argue that Flair's peak is 82 to 89, you'll get no argument from me, and I love it all. You know, I really do. Those matches that you mentioned that made the set, Charles, I helped put them on there. You know, I was the selection committee process to get those matches on those Death Valley driver sets. But I was also part of the Memphis selection committee, and Jerry Lawler has the same argument with less footage, in the sense that when he comes in 81, he's instantly in great matches with Terry Funk. In 82, he's having great matches with Flair, with Dutch Mantel, and others. In 83, with and Bill Dundee, you know, with the Bill Dundee feud. 84, continues carrying guys, and I think this was what Dylan mentioned earlier about, you know, carrying guys that don't always have great matches everywhere. No, guys like King Kong Bundy, a very green, recently... a jobber in Mid-South, Rick Rude. You know, late, probably the first exposure in 82 of, like, me seeing the first great Crusher Blackwell match that I had seen, and we know they're more out there, but, you know, seeing a Lawler versus Blackwell. And then continuing through 86, you know, again, he had the memorable feud with Savage. He had 87, one of the best matches of the 80s, the Austin Idol cage match. The AWA title run in 88 and 89. And I think we see enough Lawler week to week. And, you know, we have enough released matches to say, hey, this guy was pretty good for an awful long time having these match of the decade contenders. Maybe not as good as the peak Flair Funk matches. You know, if you want to start listing individual matches that are better. But for my money, and this is why we have these conversations, I like Jerry Lawler's wrestling style. I like Memphis style. I like Southern brawling probably more than any type of wrestling out there. So for my money, I'm going to go pay to see Jerry Lawler week in and week out every week from 82 to or 81 to 88, 89, and probably beyond that too. But
you know, I want to ask you a follow-up question to that, if I could, and I'll actually throw this question to Dylan, too. Do you think, and I'm open to whatever answer, do you think there was any point where Jerry Lawler was the single best wrestler in the world?
Yeah,
possibly.
I mean, possibly, I mean, like in 80, you know, you have contenders, Ric Flair. You have Tatsumi Fujinami in Japan. Buddy Rose in Portland, you know, so he's a contender. He's right there with them. In 87, you know, Flair is at a very high peak in 87, right? But probably not as high as like 86 when he had like the series, you know, right? I mean, I don't know. I mean, but
yeah,
in 87, like I said, he has the great Austin Idol match. He has in late 86, you know, probably the best – Bam Bam Master Bigelow's career. And then he had a couple of tags, you know, where he wrestled with Bigelow, which are probably number three on the best matches of Bigelow's career. And so in 86 and 87, I would argue, 85, I mean, and it's kind of interesting because, you know, one thing Rick and Jerry Lawler have in common, besides having wrestled Terry Funk multiple times, is they both wrestled like the AWA champions in the 80s, kind of at the peak. We have Flair versus Martel. We have Lawler versus Martel. And both matches did really well on their sets. We have Flair versus Bockwinkel, which is kind of a bummer because it's complete. And you can't really compare it to the great Lawler-Bockwinkel series of 82. The first time that I didn't see Bockwinkel as a dull 70s generic wrestler, the first time I really opened my eyes and said, hey, this guy might be better than I was giving him credit for. You know, and obviously that opinion's changed with exposure, more footage. But it didn't change with Bockwinkel's run in All Japan, that's for sure. You know, so, I would argue, you know, for you know, what I would want to see out of wrestlers, yeah, I would put Lawler out there right with, like I said, with Fujinami, with Flair, at his peak, you know.
I don't disagree with that. I would say, I mean, I think, and I've made this point before, I think from 77 to 84, that cumulative period, which I don't think is a completely arbitrary period either, because it's pretty much the last years of the territories, because when 85 hits, that's really when the takeover from WWF is, and Crockett, the two consolidated what's left, and there's really nothing else there, aside from a few scraps here and there. But those two, those two places left at that point. From that point on, Flair's the dominant guy, I think, or at least of the people we're discussing. You could argue that Terry Funk in 89, for the 6 months he was there, was every bit as good as Flair, you know, for example. But if you go back and look at that 77 to 84 window, which is real, I use 77 because that's where the footage really starts to be enough where we can sort of assess people. You at least have a few matches from guys here and there. I would say that Lawler, Terry Funk, Ric Flair, Tatsumi Fujinami, Buddy Rose, Jumbo, if you're, you know, I'm not as big a fan of Jumbo as others, but I've certainly included
in
the discussion.
Right.
Those are the guys that you would look at for number one. Those guys. I don't think we have enough lucha from that time period to say one way or the other, although you see little clips of guys like Satanico and think, holy shit, this guy's outstanding. But from that period, those are the names that I think of as serious number one. And if somebody argued for any one of those guys, I wouldn't think it was out of place. If you break it down by individual years, I think it gets tougher. And I think that's where you would really have to flesh out. You'd be a long, long debate. But if you look at cumulative chunks of time like that are sort of markers and identifiers, that makes it a little bit easier to try and, I guess, assess these people that we're talking about.
Right.
Well, I was trying to say there, too. I mean, out of Flair, Funk, and Lawler, I would say out of the 80 sets, Funk had my favorite Bockwinkel match out of those three on the All Japan set.
Which one was that? The Hanson match?
Well, Funk and Bockwinkel in All Japan, the one that made that set.
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't hear you say Bockwinkel, man. A Canadian started speaking. I automatically thought you said Bret Hart, and I just tuned you out. I'm sorry.
No.
Sorry, Dave.
Well, yeah, Funk Bockwinkel was
okay,
actually a good match. That's a good thing to bring in, because we have that as a
at
common
our
opponent, too.
I was just going to say, at least our wrestlers make it past 35, Will, so.
Really? Is Owen Hart calling? I'm sorry, what?
Come on, that's low. No. Anyway.
That was a real fall from grace there, Will.
Terrible.
Oh,
so,
man.
This is going to be like the raciest
you kill me.
Like,
you had a weight machine tied around your neck. Anyway.
Oh.
God.
Okay, so on that, for my political correct positions,
if you can tie Bret Hart into this, I'll think it's a stroke of genius. But
my Jesus Lord.
Well, I love you guys.
I thought Charles was just like, I'm not contributing to this at all. We need
Dylan,
more
take the high road for once. Yeah.
We need more Saved by the Bell references and less dead wrestler jokes.
Yeah. Let's look at Ric Flair. He's going to have an unhappy ending, but it hasn't happened yet. So we can tell jokes about him.
I want to get
plenty of happy ones on the road with Earl Hebner, but.
But it's true. He hasn't had any false starts like Jerry Lawler, so whatever. Yeah.
God Almighty, I want to ask. Okay, we don't have a lot of 1970s flair. We have some stuff from the garbage tapes with Cornette, although I don't even know how many complete matches. How much 70s flair has anybody on this panel seen?
I'd say the garbage tapes is mostly what I've seen.
Yeah.
Yeah, same here.
Will?
What was the question? I'm sorry. I was opening the door and I missed the question.
It's okay. I know you were looking at your Bret Hart fetish tapes. How much, if any, Ric Flair have you seen from the 1970s?
I've seen the studio angle with Steamboat, where he tears off Steamboat's clothes, because Flair likes to do that a lot, to other guys. That was my gay joke for the evening. But then, you know, Cornette released those Mid-Atlantic garbage tapes, and when I was putting together the Ricky Steamboat set, I included all of the Flair Steamboat segments. And you know, none of them are full matches.
Yeah.
But there are 10-minute chunks here. There are 15-minute chunks here. Sometimes, but when you watch those matches, and you pick up the Steamboat set and see those if you'd like, if you watch those matches, you know, even the fragments that we have, and even decide, you know, at one point, well, I have the beginning of this one, the middle of this one, the end of this one, you kind of get to see the house show Flair Steamboat match from the 70s. Every bit as good as their stuff from the 80s. And what makes it unique is that I guess maybe not unique, but you know, I've heard quiet Flair Steamboat matches where the crowd was pretty quiet. Not in the 70s. They're going absolutely batshit for everything these two are doing. And Flair, I think, from the little footage I've seen, probably every good in the late 70s as he was in the 80s. But we just don't have the footage to, like, say, this is Flair's definitive 70s match. Kind of like, at least like with Lawler, you know, we can kind of evaluate him against Harley Race because he did the hour-long draw with Harley Race. We can evaluate him against Bill Dundee because we have, like, the 30-minute hair versus hair match against Dundee. With Funk, we have the All Japan stuff.
Harley Race and, 75.
Right. We have that stuff. So we can evaluate them and still that they were great wrestlers, right? I mean, it's not like just because we have a minimal amount of footage that they're great, but from the pieces of those Flair Steamboat matches, both guys were really, you know, hitting it on all cylinders. I mean, I really encourage people to actually watch those garbage tapes, you know, for lack of a better term or title. Because I really think it gives you an idea of how hot Flair was in the 70s before he became, you know, the man or the nature boy, before one world title run, and how crazy the people were going for him. And him and Steamboat doing their tour. And, you know.
Well, that stuff is the reason they made him world champ. I mean, you see what everyone, what the,
right.
the guys who wanted to make as much money as possible, what they saw in him.
Yes. Yeah. I think that's totally fair. The reason I asked that question, by the way, is because one thing that really irks me, and this has less to do with Flair than it does with wrestling discussion, one thing that really irks me is when people throw around the term longevity. And the reality is, for all intents and purposes, longevity in the modern era means what can we document?
What, I have the right. feeling this will be a long conversation, so I'll be right back.
Okay. What can we document? Can we document 5 years of a career, 10, 15, 20, 25? And certain guys have certain advantages. We already talked about how Flair had an advantage in his peak because he was on top, because of his skills
and there's more of them out there. But I think lots of times people toss around the term longevity with Ric Flair. And I don't think Ric Flair's longevity is all that unique. I think based on what we can document, he's got at most 14 or 15 good years. And while that is certainly very good and better than the average wrestler, and his great years are maybe as many as 10 that we can document, I think it is very lazy to throw around that term without meaning, which maybe ties back into some of the things Charles was talking about early on with some of the people who are Flair supporters. One of the things about Funk that's a little bit different from these guys is Funk was not your traditional full-time wrestler basically from the early 80s forward. And one of the reasons that I find Funk so fascinating and that he's my favorite, aside from personal bias, which I don't, you know, have no qualms admitting, is he has, every time he pops up, it's good. And yes, there are holes, there are big gaps, there are 2 month stays here, but one of the genius things about Terry Funk, and I made this point before and I'll make it forever, Terry Funk never stayed around anywhere too long where you were sick of his act. Every single time he came into a place, he was hot, tore the house down, had good matches. Oftentimes, I mean, let's take a year like 94, which most people would think well past his prime. And I think that's fair. In 94, there was a period where Funk was wrestling in FMW, Smoky Mountain, ECW, random indies, and WCW, all within a matter of weeks, and having good matches everywhere he went, across the board. Good matches where he was extremely over, among the most over guys on the roster everywhere he went, and they were all demanding in different ways. It's not that I would say that you can't find that with Flair, and I certainly wouldn't say you can't find it with Lawler, but the ability to never get old is one thing in Funk that I think, I don't want to say it's completely unique because there are other guys I feel this way about, but I think Funk, he was the last outlaw. I mean, that was a gimmick. He was the guy who rode into town on his fucking horse, got off, had his crazy blood feud with somebody, then rode off somewhere else, did the same thing, et cetera, et cetera. And you never get tired of Funk. I love Ric Flair. But Flair fatigue is a very real thing. I love Lawler, and while I've never gotten sick of Lawler, I can see how someone would get sick of certain tropes that Lawler does. With Funk, I never got sick of him. Maybe that's my own personal bias, but I'm going to point out something that Will once said to me, which was when he was making his massive Terry Funk set, it was the only set up to that point, or at least this is what you told me, where you never got tired of watching it. Like, he had no point where you were like, fuck this guy, I'm sick of him. And I think that is a huge testament to Terry Funk.
No, you know what? I'm gonna say that at that point it's true, but part of it was because he was always wrestling different people. Like when I did the Kawada set, love Kawada. I mean, if you want to talk about peaks and you know peak years, I mean, I would put Kawada in the definition of guys like later in the 90s, obviously, of guys who have like a long peak, right? You know, where they're just good year after year after year, right? Just like, you know, Flair and Lawler. But, man, you can only watch, you know, because, you know, I don't do these sets over a 2 or 3 year period. I do them, you know, in monthly spurts and like having to watch, you know, Kawada versus Misawa Kobashi and Akiyama nonstop for like 3 weeks straight. It becomes mind-numbing. And with Funk, you never got that. Because one night he's wrestling Carlos Colon, the next he's wrestling Stan Hansen, the next he's wrestling Ric Flair, the next he's wrestling Lawler, the next he's wrestling his brother in a very dull hour-long match, but whatever. You know, but the point stands, I never got tired of him, whereas even like when I made the Four Horsemen set, and I mean, that's really Flair's peak right there, right? Like, where just everybody was drawn into the Flair trap. If you weren't in the Flair trap before, you know, TBS went national, or before cable television, 86, 87, you were hooked. You know, you were in there with the Horsemen, love them or hate them. And even then, you know, you didn't have the diversity of opponents that they did. What saves you on a set like that is that you're not just focusing on Flair. You're focusing on Flair, Arn, Tully, Wyndham, Luger, you know, whoever. And you know, that helps you through, you know. But, I mean, Funk, you know, it was just he had a different match. And this is me kind of helping your case here, Dylan. He had a different match for every opponent, you know, in every territory. If he had to work on the mat and, you know, be the mat wrestler, he was going to be the mat wrestler. If he had to be the crazy old wild man, he was a crazy old wild man. If he had to do a death match with Onita in Japan, he did the death match. You know, I mean, he you know, if he had to do Southern tag team wrestling, you know, he did it. You know, he was able to, I think, fit into those territories as seamlessly as anybody in the history of wrestling.
Yeah, yeah, and that's kind of my big picture point, is that Funk has a unique case as the greatest of all time guy because he doesn't have that role of an ace. He doesn't have that period. Well, he does, but we don't have it on tape. He doesn't have that sort of typical, here's his list of great matches. You know, I mean, he's not that kind of guy. I mean, not that he doesn't have great matches, but it's a totally different. If you're presenting a case for Terry Funk as the best wrestler of all time, the narrative is not the normal narrative, where you look at X number of matches, this is his run as the ace of a promotion, look all the great things he did. With Terry Funk, the case is, look at how versatile this guy was, and look at how consistently entertaining he was, and consistently good he was, and how you never got tired of him. I mean, that's what I always come back to with him is, he knew exactly how long to stay in the promotion before people either got sick of him or the act he was currently working, because he was very versatile, got old. He never let his act get old. And I think, in a way, that's genius. You don't have he redefined himself multiple times. Even within the crazy old man thing, there are multiple crazy old men within the Terry Funk Milo. It's not one guy. I mean, you've got the guy from 89 is not the same as the guy in 94, you know, and the guy who was a babyface in ECW is not the same as the guy who was a heel in ECW.
Right.
And these are different versions of that crazy old man. So when we, you know, that's not a catch-all, is my point. It's much broader
than
that.
Can I give a couple of examples of the crazy old man like ECW? Is you have wild, I'm working on adrenaline, and you know, my brain's been a little bit scrambled, so I don't quite know where I'm at. Crazy Terry Funk, right? Where he's just swinging chairs, you know, bats out. But then you also have, please, legs, don't give out on me because I need to make a payment on my ranch, old man Terry Funk, in the same promotion. Am I right, though? I mean, it's really kind of this unique look, or, you know, like when you like the psychological look at a wrestler where you're like, holy shit, you know. I can understand why he keeps doing what he's doing, you know, and at the same time you think, wow, that's kind of like why you wish this motherfucker would have stayed retired in 83, because you don't know if he's really all there, you know, he's kind of fucking crazy, but then, you know, he has an interview backstage and, you know, he's like, oh, shucks, guys, you know, just me and my brother Dory, the best wrestler that ever lived. Fuck you, man. Your brother's not the best, you know. You move on. But here, I want to make an argument for Flair, because I just did one for Funk, and I want Charles to respond, is that Flair in the 80s, actually, as traveling NWA world champion, actually kind of at the time had the same thing, because he does his program with the Von Erichs in 82, but at the same time, he's doing a program in Memphis in 82, and they're completely isolated, and he stays, he puts over the babyface hero of the territory without giving up the belt, obviously. And then he moves on, and, you know, as touring world champ, because we get to see him in there. We get to see him do his Mid-South shtick. We get to see him in all Japan and in these different territories kind of do the same thing, where he gets to go to these other places, do his thing. And, you know, the Flair burnout that you talk about, that's probably from seeing Flair on TV week in and week out nationally every week from 86 to 2007. You know, I think that's where that comes from. But, like, in the 80s, I don't think that was really an issue, because he was kind of doing that same thing. I'm the nature boy. you don't deserve to see me wrestle, but I'm going to do it just because I'm a nice guy. Lawler challenges him. The Von Erichs are like, well, shucks, Rick, you know, we're good God-fearing Christians, man. We want to wrestle you. And, you know, they do their shtick. The Japanese, I don't speak Japanese, but if I did, I'd do a jumbo impersonation. And he does the same thing that we're talking about in Funk, but Funk did it over his career, you know, that we have on tape, whereas Flair kind of did it as touring the world champ. And so, Charles, what do you think about me sticking up for your boy Flair there?
I appreciate it. Thank you. actually, I mean, I think that's an interesting point. I've talked about, like, the formula of Ric Flair and the predictability of Ric Flair before, but I kind of have a fresh twist on it. I think the ability, okay, what Terry Funk did was very impressive in the sense, you know, that he kind of picked his spots. When I say that, that sounds kind of like a backhanded compliment, but I really don't mean it that way. What I mean was that it was impressive that he did exactly what Dylan said. He could come into an area and then, you know, stay exactly the right amount of time and then, you know, get out of town. But I think where Ric Flair is impressive is that he's the first wrestler of his kind. He's the very first ever NWA world champion who was so broadcast on national television. You know, I there wasn't anyone like him before that. I think it's impressive to me. I consider it a strength of his that he didn't have to change his act very much, and he managed to keep it going and stay over. And, you know, it people kind of knew what they were going to get, but they were excited to see it anyway. And he was able to do it on a national scale for so long. I mean, I might be, you know, we can talk about it all day long among hardcore fans, but I would say at least, it was probably, 1988 or so? That's probably the first time that Ric Flair actually started feeling stale. It took that long for your more casual fans who were just tired of seeing Ric Flair bleed and then get pinned and then the referee come in and reverse the decision because of something that happened as part of the ref.
I don't think that had anything to do with Flair, though, so much as being the victim of booking, or booking himself that way. Whoever was the booker at the time, that's a booker's choice. You know, that's not.
It is a booker's choice, but I guess the point I wanted to make is that Flair was being booked like that for years, and it took years for it to have any effect. I mean, Flair could do angles like that and do finishes like that over and over and then just come out on TBS in a suit with his sunglasses the next week, and it was like it never happened.
Well,
I mean, by 88, definitely, I think for people who were watching wrestling at the time, they were sick of seeing Ric Flair hang on to the title, get himself disqualified, or, you know, be so lucky and have the blood in his blonde hair while he's grabbing the gold and running out of the building. I think people were tired of that at that point. 1989 came along, and that kind of proved that the problem wasn't Flair. The problem was, like you said, the way he was being booked. So I think it's kind of impressive that a guy can run the same act for so long and not really have to change it.
Well, then let me follow up with that. I'm sorry, Dylan. Would you say that's equally impressive that Lawler was basically Lawler, who was just kind of fed whoever happened to be in Memphis that week? He had the same act essentially from 81 to 88 as babyface of Memphis, and was able to still draw week in and week out in that one territory. You know,
yeah,
because people had seen Lawler wrestle hundreds of times. It wasn't like those people that went every week to see Lawler wrestle hadn't seen the guy and didn't know his shtick and didn't know his act. They believed in Jerry Lawler, or, you know, whatever, Memphis wrestling. So the same thing could be applied that, you know, it took, you know, that's kind of the impressive thing about Memphis wrestling, right, is that because they ran on a shoestring budget and because, you know, the people of Memphis were invested into wrestling, there's a reason Memphis kind of lasted longer than all the other territories. Was it as successful as the Glory Days? No. But there's still a reason that it existed, you know, as Jerry Lawler's playground for so long.
Yeah, one of the biggest positives I can say about Jerry Lawler is that he was able to break up and team with so many of the same people over and over and over without ever looking like a dumbass.
And it worked.
It's natural, man. It was like family fights, man.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, because he would trust them again, but people didn't say, "Wow, Jerry Lawler is stupid." I mean, when you compare that to someone like Sting, and it's kind of funny the difference. And part of that is booking, but I really do think part of that is performance also, because Lawler could convince people that he wasn't stupid before he did something that was stupid.
Well, he could convince them because he was an all-time great mic guy too. I mean, that's a big part of it. You know, I mean, Jerry Lawler could cut a promo that would. You know, explicitly lay out his reasons for trusting somebody again or for, you know, whatever. And that is key. And having that personal connection with the audience is a huge, 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 huge part of it.
Yeah. Hey, you know, when you speak about mic work, one of the things I love is there's a point in 1990, or it was 91, and Charles can correct me which year it is. I don't know, man. The years blend together. Where Eddie Gilbert's turning face, okay? But they have bigger fish to fry. I'm going to say it's 91 because I think it's Team Texas, Eric Embry and Tom Pritchard and that group when they were running there, where Lawler just had a blood feud with Gilbert, right? Gotten run over by a car and all this other crazy shit. But Gilbert and Embry have a fight. They carve Gilbert up with barbed wire. Okay, so Gilbert wants his revenge, but he has to team with a guy like Jarrett or, you know, Lawler. And Lawler's like, look, I hate you, but I hate those two motherfuckers more. So if it means to get to them and I team with you, you untrustworthy little fucking prick, I will team with this prick to kill those two pricks. And he had a great knack for doing that. Whereas sometimes with Flair... And this is a criticism more of booking than a Flair, but I would say it's credible. Sometimes with Flair, you're like, why the fuck did he just do that? Like, you know, why did the Horseman turn heel in 90? You know, or I think people wanted Flair to be a babyface longer than he was in a lot of times.
Absolutely.
Just because Flair loved being a heel, he hurt himself.
Forget Sink. I grew up around that. You know, that was like the formative years of my wrestling youth, where I was going to shows, you know, nonstop all over the Carolinas and Georgia. I mean, look, that's a fact. Nobody wanted Flair to turn back. There's no question about that. I don't think that's even open for debate. I mean, one other point I would make as regards mic work, and not just mic work in a vacuum, but mic work as it maybe relates to getting over storylines and feuds. Flair always made you want to see him, whereas I think Lawler always made you want to see the match. That's a big difference. With Flair, that's not to say Flair didn't put over the match, because he absolutely did. But I think with Flair, he made you want to see him first. I don't even know if it was, to be fair, that's part of his character. You know, this egoist, kind of lunatic. but I always got the impression watching Flair promos that you, when it was over with, you wanted to see Ric Flair wrestle somebody. It almost didn't matter. That's why, you know, whereas with Lawler, after a great Lawler promo, you want to see the match that Lawler is talking about. But then again, that may also have something to do with the way Memphis television was produced. Because Flair oftentimes had multiple guys that were on his radar as challengers, even after the national consolidation by Crockett. So, it's a little bit. That's kind of. Maybe that's a pedantic, but I don't think it is. I would just say that was always the impression I got. Yes, you can find exceptions to that, but as a rule, that's kind of how I feel about both those guys' promos.
I do agree with that, because I think I think Ric Flair was a fantastic promo, and I think that's without debate. But if you look at the general act of Ric Flair. Ric Flair, I think this happens with, I mean, not just Flair, but it happens with wrestling in general. It gets dumbed down over time. So you have wrestlers who are aping the people that they grew up on or that they were huge fans of, but they don't quite understand why they did everything that they did. And so they're copying certain aspects of their act, but not really grasping the full picture. So, like, I think we can all admit, for example, Shawn Michaels copied a lot from Flair.
Sure.
But what he copied from Flair was that Flair all of Ric Flair's matches were about Ric Flair. All of Shawn Michaels' matches were about Shawn Michaels, but the difference is that Flair would actually make the other person look good because it was what they did to Ric Flair. Shawn Michaels was more a guy who would make himself look good because look what I withstood that this other guy did to me. So I would agree that, I mean, Ric Flair was definitely about making you want to see him. I think a lot of the appeal of his promos was just you'd see this guy talk about all of his money and women, and you're like, is this guy for real? I got to go check him out. You know, but I think that he influenced a generation of people that didn't really get all of his act, and so they just copied the parts that they liked at the time, and it wasn't as good.
I would also add that what Flair was very good at was when he stood by the horseman, when, you know, or a tag partner, whoever, he elevated them by proxy. You know, by being next to Ric Flair, by getting Ric Flair's endorsement. I'm sorry, I mean, I watched the footage. Arn and Ole were hot. Tully was hot. But Ric Flair giving them his seal of approval, these are my guys, this is who I party with, this is my crew, these are my cousins, all of that raised those guys up to where they could main event a house show in Crockett in 86, you know, without having Flair on the card. Why? Because they had Flair's charisma kind of rubbed off, you know, it's like... Ole Anderson's I am the Rock shirt or whatever, you know. It's like it had a little bit of Flair charisma on the sleeve, you know. Even though Ole was a draw previously. I'm just saying, Flair raised those guys up. When Flair, you know, we'll talk about Canadians here. When Flair endorsed Malenko and Benoit and Mongo and Pillman in the 90s, those guys were taken seriously by the fans because Flair said to take them seriously. Regardless of what the booking did to those guys, Flair said, let's raise these guys up. And they were raised up in the eyes of the fans. And that's why people were so pissed off, because then they were treated like jobbers or, you know, internal disputes or whatever would kind of sidetrack Flair's intentions. And then it makes him look like a guy who doesn't know talent or whatever, you know, whatever. But still, being next to Flair helped a lot of guys.
Yeah, and I think one of my favorite examples of that, of just him, just his words carrying a little bit of weight, was when they kicked Luger out of the Horsemen, and he did the promo on TBS, and I think he said, something to the effect of, I hope you enjoyed your fun while it lasted, because it stops here, because in this business, you don't pass go until Ric Flair says so. And I remember thinking, that was such a great line.
that's excellent. And vintage Ric Flair.
Now, Dylan, we talked about Lawler's ability. Oh, is Dave back?
Dave, you back?
Yeah, I've been back for a while, man.
I thought so, but I wanted to make sure you hadn't disappeared into a black hole, because we've been filibustering, to quote the great Dusty Rhodes. Do you have anything that you wanted to pitch out that we have not been touching on?
One of the things I wanted to look at as far as Funk goes is you used the word redefined himself, Dylan. I mean,
yes.
He redefined himself and, like, redefined roles and in a revolutionary way. Like, the role of the NWA world champion as a, you know, he was a brawling world champion. He'd really been the first one to that point. Then from there, you know, like, as the Gaijin babyface in All Japan. And then again, you know, as kind of redefining hardcore wrestling in the 90s with ECW and whatnot. So, and even probably his heel run in 89 was quite revolutionary. So,
oh yeah,
just in terms of a guy who can jumpstart and, you know, really come up with something that hasn't been seen before, he's one of the top guys. So,
yeah, that's actually a good point, and it's kind of funny because I think all of you guys on the phone and anybody who really is used to listening to my ranting or reading my ranting knows that one of the things I value least in wrestling is innovation. Like, I think that's like the most overrated thing in wrestling and probably the least important thing that is touted as being important. And I almost guarantee you Charles would agree with me. And if possible, I don't know if either you will or Dave would. But
Dylan, hold on, dude. I'm arguing for Lawler, bro. The model of consistency here. You know?
Which, by the way, I'm still trying to figure out how he got away with calling people like motherfucking pricks on TV. but we'll get back to that later.
With Funk, I do think that talk about all-time cursing rants. The unedited version of the Empty Arena with Lawler or with Funk viciously cursing out Lance Russell is hilarious. But I think it's weird because he is an example of a guy who kind of was innovative in some ways, you know, and that's probably what kept him fresh is because of the fact that he did, like you said, innovate roles. I cannot say enough about the All Japan stuff, I think, really, because I don't know, I mean, when most people think of Terry Funk now, they think of hardcore legend and NWA champion, and anything that happened in between those two periods is kind of like, okay, anything that happened between 89 and 75, I don't want to say nobody knows about it, but it sort of gets obscured. And there was a lot of stuff that happened in that time period. And the key thing that happened in that time period was All Japan. And if you look at something, like his best match with Hansen, although he had many, but if you look at that great match with Hansen, that is a totally unique wrestling spectacle that's unlike anything you will have seen. If you watch him, one thing that really amazed me was there's a match where I think it's him and Dory versus it might be Mil Máscaras and Dos Caras, but Funk is rolling around doing Lucha's mat work spots and then does a dive in, like, 1977, you know? And you're like, what the hell? Because, where did that come from? And how many times did you see that with him where you'd be watching a match and he'd be doing his thing and then there'd be one moment where you're like, what the hell is that? Like, he was really good at plugging in individual spots or individual moments and sometimes they may have gone a little bit too far into the realm of silly or over the top, but I don't think all that often, actually, because they were so unique and weirdly different. I mean, one of the ones I always really remember that stands out is from ECW. There's one of it was a tag match brawl in 95, I want to say, and Funk goes to run down the aisle, and he's found a toolbox to use as a weapon. Now, in ECW, the average spot you're going to see there is either somebody's going to open the toolbox and hit somebody with a wrench, or somebody's going to throw the toolbox at somebody. No. Terry Funk slyly opens the toolbox as he's running. And as he runs forward, all the contents of the toolbox fall on his head. And now he's got to sell the fact that he's dropped a bunch of metal tools on his own head. Now, is that silly? Yes. But in the context of a wild, out-of-control ECW brawl, it actually makes sense. And it was a unique and interesting spot that I can't imagine any other wrestler doing. And there's a whole lot of times in Terry Funk's career where, oddly enough, him innovating or doing some nice little touch like that really, really stands out. And you can't – I don't want to say you can't say that for Lawler or Flair because I don't think that's true. But I think with Funk, those big moments stand out more, at least they do to me.
Has anyone else in wrestling history ever used a loaded chicken as a weapon?
Well, the plastic bag. I mean, I'm sure somebody had done that before then, but Funk coming out of the crowd with the plastic bag, like, still in, like, the torn-up clothes that he was wearing at the Great American Bash, if I'm not mistaken, and tying the bag around Flair's head, in Colombia when I was there. I mean, like, that kind of stuff... Those moments really, really stand out. I mean, the Empty Arena, there's a lot of them. There's a whole lot of them with Terry Funk, especially for a guy who wasn't around one place for a long time. Because other guys have advantages of sort of having lots of definitive moments, because if you're an icon that's synonymous with one territory or one title, it stands to reason you're going to have a whole lot of moments that are going to stand out in the history of that place.
Right.
Funk doesn't really have that advantage. I mean, he was all over the place, and there's all these different instances and moments that you can kind of point to that really stand out. So,
I will argue that Terry Funk, or not Terry Funk, Jerry Lawler was part of the concession stand brawl. Wait, was he part of the first one?
God, who knows? I can't keep up. They keep saying, it seems like the first one has been relegated to the second one three or four different times, so I have no clue what the hell the first one was.
It was the Blonde Bombers, Latham, and
Ferris.
Versus shit. I know Lawler and Dundee were in the great ones from
shit. Was it them and the Bomb Bombers? Was it Lawler and Dundee versus the Bomb Bombers, maybe?
I honestly can't even remember.
Shit. I'm trying to think because, I'm just going to say that Jerry Lawler booked that, not Jerry Jarrett. Just to give Jerry Lawler credit.
It was a couple of motherfucking pricks.
Yeah, dude. Fucking couple of motherfucking pricks, man. Pair of them have blonde hair, you know. Fucking the first guy to do, like, the concert, you know, or do the recording. Well, he's probably not the first to do that either. But we're going to say he did. First U.S. hair versus hair match. Then the Lucha guy started copying that shit from him.
They ripped up. You know what, though? One thing we didn't mention about Lawler, because we mentioned, you know, Funk and Flair touring around. Lawler actually toured around more than people remember. I mean, we talk about Lawler as this Memphis mainstay, but during that period where they sort of cast him in the role as a touring champion when the wrestling world was being shaken up, so to speak, in the late 80s and early 90s, Lawler's good at it. It's not like at no point did he seem out of place doing that. It's just he did it in a different era.
No, and I think what hurts him there, though, is that whereas Flair was a game changer, you know, like you had big gates in Memphis, you had big gates in Texas, Mid-South for Flair matches, Lawler wasn't like, you know, he wasn't, selling those places out, you know, but from an in-ring standpoint, I say those matches hold up just as well. And what's even impressive is because when you look at, like, say, Flair versus Kerry Von Erich, Flair got Kerry Von Erich when Kerry was kind of at his peak, where Kerry was having great matches kind of with everybody in 84 and 85, if you watch the Texas. Lawler got great matches with Kerry in 88 and 89, stoned, lost soul, 1 foot Kerry Von Erich, you know. And to me, that's just kind of a testament to Lawler saying, this isn't the same guy Flair got to wrestle. Why can't I have that guy? But I'm going to make it work anyway. Fuck it. You know?
Yeah. I mean, that's a fair point. I mean, the thing is about this debate to me is I like all three guys a lot. Like, I mean, and I've said this before. In fact, I said this on the Terry Funk show that we did. Dave will probably remember this. I said at the time, Jerry Lawler is a guy I could realistically see topping Funk, you know, with time if I saw more things, because there is so much out there. And here's one area, and this will seem like I'm going after Charles, but I'm really not. This one area where I actually think Flair, this is why the peak argument for Flair is so important, because actually, in terms of being good for a long period of time on tape, Flair is last out of these three, in my opinion. I think.
I totally agree with that.
Well, yeah, what was the argument? I'm sorry, Dylan. I know.
I just said in terms of being good for a long period of time and showing up on tape being good, Flair is the least of these three.
Yeah, I don't think there's even close to an argument there. But you know,
and while I did really like Flair's run as the American Onita from, like, you know, DCW, I really actually like a lot of that stuff. That was like an isolated period. To me, Flair was like literally the worst wrestler in the world in 2003, 2004. There was nobody I dreaded seeing more because it was so sad. I was watching this guy who visibly calling spots in every match, couldn't get up for a signature spot. And I don't really think that should be a big part of the greatest of all time debate. Not a big part anyway, but I think that hurts Flair because it's hard to put that in the back burner. It's hard to say, okay, this really shouldn't matter because he did before, because that's the last stuff you saw. And you can't totally get that out of your head.
Well, it's not just that. It's just that because he has a few contemporaries like Tenryu, Lawler, and Funk who maybe weren't doing it on WWE TV. Because Lawler's WWE run, I mean, I think I'd admit this is much, a lot of it's largely trash, you know, except for a couple of moments I want to touch upon later on. But we have plenty of, like, Lawler in the Indies, Lawler in Memphis on YouTube. That kind of shows, hey, Lawler's still doing his thing at 60, and he's doing it well. Terry Funk is having some of these real highlight matches. Like, one of my most underrated Terry Funk matches I really love is the Terry Funk versus CM Punk match from ROH.
Yep.
And I think and it got shit on at the time by like kind of like your ROH work rate crew, because one, it had a shit finish, which ROH didn't do at the time. Remember, everybody always got pinned or submitted, and you know, every match ended cleanly or was supposed to, you know, because that's the way modern wrestling fans went through wrestling, and it had that kind of finish, and it was worked in kind of an old school manner. But Funk was having this match at 60 or 55 or whatever. Whereas with Flair, you just wish, because he was on TV week in, week out, they would say, hey, you know what, this week we're going to work my kind of match, you know. And, you know, I'm one of the few people, like, you know, at the places we frequent, you know, your DVDVRs, Pro Wrestling Only, that likes Flair HBK. I like the story. I like the way that match went down, you know. Mainly because I love Ric Flair as a wrestler, so I'm kind of emotionally invested in that being his supposed last match. Now, he blew it all to hell later in TNA, but whatever. That's the moment, you know? And because we love Flair, I am emotionally invested in that, you know? Just like I am emotionally invested in seeing Jerry Lawler get his world title shot on pay-per-view. This is what I was alluding to earlier. Has anyone else been able to get as good of a match out of The Miz as Jerry Lawler? 60-fucking-year-old Jerry Lawler, the night after his mother died or some shit, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, Lawler's doing this at that age. And I think that's, intentionally, he was having matches on, like, my Match of the Year sets at 60. And I think that hurts Flair in that sense, that I think Flair's ability was there, because I think, like, the Shawn match shows that. I think that Flair is a smart guy, you know, and I think he said, well, fuck, man, if my body's failing me, I am going to be the fucking American Onita. You know, I mean, that's actually a smart move if that's what you have to do to get your reactions and, you know, and to get people still care about you, you know, at that age, if you're going to be in the ring. But, you know, I think it does hurt if your contemporaries are still doing what they do with kind of like great matches being thrown in when you get a chance to see them. You know, so.
I've got a lot of responses to that.
Okay, great. And we're going to let you talk. Filibuster, brother. Filibuster.
Okay. Oh, great, great. So the first thing I would say is that, I mean, if you're looking for someone to defend, like old man Ric Flair, or yeah, I would say even Ric Flair after his first WWF run in the early 90s, it's not going to be me. That doesn't mean that there weren't moments that I enjoyed, but that's not where I'm making the argument. But I think you know that. But the second point that I want to make is one, I want to tell you why I think it's unfair. Because if you look at, I mean, there are other people, and I know that these aren't people that you really advocate for greatest of all time, no one on this phone call, but they are people that are advocated for greatest of all time. No one knocks Jumbo Saruta down a peg because he was working comedy matches after he got hepatitis. Nobody knocks Kenta Kobashi down a peg because of the matches he had after he came back from cancer. So, to me, I think if you're going to include that part of Flair's career in those conversations, and you have to do the same for Kobashi, you have to do the same for Jumbo. And I don't really see anyone doing that. So I'd like for someone to explain to me why Ric Flair gets singled out in that category when the rules don't seem to apply to anyone else.
So Dylan, can I rebut this, or do you want to do
it? Yes.
Okay. I would say, just for the two examples you used, Kobashi and Jumbo, it's because their health failed them. It had nothing to do with their skill as wrestler, you know what I mean? It was a health issue, whereas maybe Flair had health issues. I mean, we don't know, right? I mean, but there was nothing that said, hey, Ric Flair had these health issues. It just all of a sudden turned like Ric Flair is not fucking thinking like a smart wrestler. You know, it's not like, I mean, Jumbo understood, hey, I'm done. I have to be a comedy wrestler. You know, Kobashi knew, hey, I'm going to do my slap fest and my chop-a-thons because I'm done. It's cancer. I need to pay a bill. Whereas with Ric Flair, he was still going out there trying to be the man, trying to be the best, even if, you know, he wasn't. But when you're trying to be that, you know what I mean? At least Kobashi and Jumbo kind of understood it's over, whereas Ric Flair was in denial all that time saying it's not over. You know, And that's why I give him credit for the HBK match, is because even though he couldn't do like the flare flip or whatever, he didn't try. You know, it was kind of like he knows this is the end, and he conveyed it. And for once, it felt like Ric Flair was a human in the ring again. You know,
yes,
and I like that about that match, and that's why I always give him credit for that. You know.
But I mean, I would argue that as you get further along in time, like the late 90s, early 2000s, Ric Flair was not trying to be the Ric Flair of the 80s. He wasn't trying to go 60 minutes. He wasn't trying to carry guys who were lower on the totem pole. I don't think he saw himself that way anymore.
Okay. You know, and you could be right about that, too. I mean, and Ric Flair had, you know, like the Bret Hart match from Sold Out 98 is credited as being a good match. Now, I know our Canadian friend here would say that's all because of Bret Hart, but, you know. Whatever. Whatever, Dave. I'm not trying to draw you into this conversation or anything. But, you know, and yeah, he was kind of the elder statesman then, right? I'm sure, I mean, Flair was still drawn in 1999. You know, him and Hogan did the best buy rates, right? I mean, yeah, still kind of showed, hey, the old guy still got it, you know? We'll give him credit for that.
He still draws now.
You know, but what we're saying is that guys that kind of have the longevity, and we're not even arguing, we're just discussing longevity as an issue, and you made a valid point, like, hey, man, we're not arguing that because Ric Flair was a shadow of himself, you know, for his last WWF run, that he shouldn't be in the conversation. We're just saying that it should still be discussed, and you know, we'll have, you know, a view, but, you know, it does hurt when a guy like Tenryu, who's just fucking old as fuck and grumpy as fuck, still having great fucking matches, you know, but he's not trying to be Tenryu, the ace of the promotion anymore either. He's kind of the journeying wonder man of Japan, you know, popping up in random indies.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah,
Lawler is like a weekend warrior now. I mean, he knows he's no longer the king of Memphis. He's an announcer who's a weekend warrior, but he's still kind of producing in the ring, and that's kind of why we're comparing him to those guys, is that they're not trying to be the ace of a promotion either, you know. But at the same time, like, from a ring work quality standpoint, they were still producing, and, you know, at least till Lawler's heart attack. But Flair wasn't. That's what hurts as a Flair fan, because we've seen other old guys kind of adjust to being old and doing what works, and Flair didn't. And I think that's kind of my.
And I can see that. I can see that point. I guess my thing is that the reason to praise those guys, but it's not necessarily the standard. The reason that it's praiseworthy is because it's not the standard. So I really don't think that. I mean, to me, it sounds like you're saying, well, Ric Flair eventually became old, and he wasn't as good anymore. And that's somehow,
yeah.
And that's like, yes, that's true. What's the point? I guess that's kind of how I see that.
I guess the point is, well, it's amazing that Flair, Tenryu, or not Flair, Lawler, Tenryu, Funk, these other guys we talk about, that they are still great. You know, that it's kind of like not, I mean, maybe it's using Flair as the guy to knock, to strengthen a Lawler case or a Flair case, or I'm sorry, God, man, a Lawler case, a Funk case, or a Tenryu case. But it's just kind of illustrating that, hey, when you get old, you can still be a pretty fucking great wrestler. And that wasn't Flair's argument. That's not very nice for Flair.
One thing I will say in defense of Flair on this front is Flair logged a lot more miles than the other two. And I don't just mean in terms of drug use and alcoholism. Flair logged a lot more miles, because while Funk probably had a very similar schedule to Flair for a few years, obviously he scaled back and had a much, you know, and while he was still going around jet setting various places, it wasn't week in and week out as much. And
yeah, definitely not
Lawler,
as many miles
Lawler
as 16-year-olds
was working
either.
The Memphis Loop. You know, he was working the Memphis Loop. And the big towns on the Memphis Loop at that. He wasn't working the tiny little Mississippi spot shows. So Lawler, both of those guys do have that they can, I mean, I'm not saying that as a whole. I don't want to come across like an apologist here, but my point would be Flair definitely logged more miles. So from that perspective, it does sort of make sense that his breakdown would be more extreme.
Yeah,
he's also a guy who literally broke his back in an airplane.
And then had his peak, right? Yeah.
Yes.
You know.
Am I alone in actually really liking his late WWF stuff? WWE stuff. I mean, I really liked his, you know, I think he was a part of getting Batista over by working with him as tag champs. They put
no, you're alone, dude. It's just you, dude. It's a Canadian thing.
Okay.
I would actually agree with Dave in the sense that Flair, even now, the WWE is trying to use him to get over the Miz as a babyface. They know it's not working, so they're like, well, shit, let's put him with Ric Flair on this segment on Raw. I mean, am I insane, or was that clear that that's what they were doing? Like,
clear.
This guy can't get cheered on his own. He's lame as shit on his own as a babyface. Let's put Ric Flair out there because he definitely won't get booed with Ric Flair. I mean, like, that was the perception that I got of that entire segment. And I think Dave is right. Batista
and so transparent, bro. So transparent.
Batista and Orton got more from their association with Flair than they did from Triple H. I really believe that. I mean, now granted, I don't like Triple H, but I honestly believe that's true. I think they got in evolution in terms of. It's at that point you made later or earlier. Flair's
later.
By
you're
seeing
into the future now.
Yeah, Flair by mere association, you know,
like
can elevate people even when he wasn't that good in the ring. What I don't agree with Dave is in saying that he was good in the ring at that point. I thought he was awful in 2003 and 2000, like breaking Dylan's heart level bad in 2003 and 2004. I do think he had a comeback run, like I said, as the sort of American Onita guy, which I think is a credit to him. And in a way, I think some people saw that as sad, and I get that. But I saw it as kind of a smart way of revitalizing a career and making this guy interesting again. And really, frankly, I think in some ways he was basically taking Terry Funk's middle-aged and crazy gimmick and spinning it into a WWE character. I mean, like, that's kind of the impression I got from that run. You know, not that he was directly ripping off Funk, but that it was a similar dynamic. You know, this guy who's old, he's lost his skills, but he's still a dirty fighter. And he will fight anybody in any setting, and he doesn't give a shit. I mean, you've got the Last Man Standing match with Triple H, the cage match with Triple H, the TLC with Edge, the matches with the barbed wire and the fat match with the Big Show and Foley. All of those matches are good matches. Like, I mean, and this is after the period where everybody, even most hardcore Ric Flair fans, would say he wasn't very good. So even as we're saying he wasn't very good in this period, you point to an awful lot of matches where he was really good. So
you
can't. It's not a uniform statement. To me, really, the big knock on Flair in terms of time period would be maybe 99 through 2005 or 2004. I think in that period he was really bad. But a lot of that had to do with miles logged, terrible booking in WCW, and I think him having no confidence in himself, which is something that he's talked about himself many times, you know. So,
Dylan, would you agree? I've always kind of had this mindset that Flair, had he been used properly in WCW, he would have been the guy for years that could have come back and done the once a year match at WrestleMania that would have drawn big.
I agree with that. Absolutely, I agree with that. He's a legend that people want to see. He's not a legend people don't want to see. You know, I love Mick Foley in his peak. Mick Foley is a legend people don't want to see. They're tired of Mick Foley. Like, when he shows up, it's uncomfortable, to watch. Terry Funk, as much as I love him, there were times, you know, when they brought him in as the commissioner in WCW and everybody wanted it to be Flair, I love Terry Funk, and he's my favorite, you know, but
people
at
turned
that
on
point,
him, though.
It was like, man, this is sad to watch because people wanted Flair, you know.
Yeah.
And he is a guy that definitely could have been your Undertaker type, where you plug guys in. I mean, obviously they couldn't have done the streak, but he could be a guy like that, absolutely. And I think he's a guy who could have done that maybe better than anybody currently on the roster.
Well, you know, just to throw in guys that were set is like, you know, when Punk was having his verbal sparring with Lawler, right? And then Lawler finally gets in the ring. I always got from the crowd reaction, like when Lawler fought Miz, that the crowd wanted to see Lawler versus Miz. I don't think the crowd wanted to see Lawler versus Punk. You know what I mean? Like, it was sad because I wanted my favorite guy, the guy I think is the best, who is still, I thought, one of the best guys to put in there. And the guy I thought could, you know, go you know, mouth to mouth, mouth to mouth. That sounds so bad. Who could promo to promo with a
especially
with
where
mouth,
we saw
you know.
Lawler get the mouth to mouth.
Yeah. Oh man, you're killing me, Dave. Yeah. Children.
Okay,
anyway, so, but you know, it was kind of sad to see Lawler too. Even you know, before that, just that crowd didn't really give a shit about him either. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
They didn't want to.
That match, I actually think was Lawler Punk. I actually think was a good match. It's just that the crowd.
Yeah, it was a really great match. That kind of reinforces my point that the guy could still go in the ring for at least one more week.
Whoa.
Yeah, I'm here.
Wow, that was weird. Dead air.
Yeah. You know what that was called? Y'all shitting on my joke, man. Fuck all of you. Okay. Man.
You know
sorry.
You know.
Sorry. One joke too many, man. I should know when to quit. You know, the best comics are the ones who know just when to shut up. You know. Whereas Dave always knows when to talk. I don't know when to shut up. And I think that's a real issue I'm going to have to resolve going forward. Anyway, all
Dave,
right,
you
so, got to
step in
back.
And moderate.
What's that, Dylan?
I said you got to step in and moderate.
Turn
okay,
off the fucking Leo Burke tape and pay attention to the conversation, Dave.
If we're going to be fully transparent here, I'm actually doing some Sudoku puzzles here. But.
Oh, shit.
That's classic.
Fucking Sudoku, dude. He said, fuck these American guys. I don't want to talk about them. If Bret Hart's not in the conversation and this greatest of all time conversation, it's not a valid conversation. Americans.
I could have tried to argue that, but I am not.
Three Americans blowing hot air. You know.
Well, I think what I would like to do is do some comparisons with other guys who do come up and argue, you know, if we can keep it brief on each of them, like why Funk, Lawler, or Flair come above them. So, I mean, Bret Hart could be one.
Oh, man. Bret Hart, really?
I don't think there's much question that all of them would be probably above him.
Miles,
evidently, there is some question for some people.
Yeah.
I don't think it's a real question. I mean, one thing to me with Bret is, like, and I'm just going to, I made this point the other day on ProWrestlingOnly.com. There's a cheap plug. That's a cheap plug for Charles. I don't think like with Bret with the peak of Flair. I think we all agree it was a great peak. With the peak of Bret, I don't think it was as long. I don't think the peak was as good. But more to the point, the stuff before his peak, which I think he's often cited as being a guy who was really consistent for a long time. I'm sorry, the Hart Foundation really weren't that good a team. You know, I wouldn't say they were a bad tag team. I think that's way too far. But in terms of great tag teams and even great, more to point, great tag team wrestlers, Bret Hart is not high on my list of great tag team wrestlers. It's not that he's a bad tag team wrestler. I think that's insane to say. He's perfectly suitable at it. But he's not Ricky Morton. He's not Dennis Condrey. He's not Ronnie Garvin, even. He's
Dylan, people grew up watching the Hart Foundation. How can you say that?
I know it is hard to believe that people grew up watching them and they have the same attire and everything. But I just don't I think that, like, with a lot of guys that you could say this about. I mean, I'll throw out another name who I think maybe I feel more strongly about in a positive way than Bret, Eddie Guerrero, for example. Eddie had a great peak and was a very versatile wrestler, maybe even more versatile than anybody in this conversation at his absolute peak. I don't know. But does anybody really think that Eddie Guerrero is better than any of these three guys? I mean, I guess if you were looking strict based on peak, you could make some really isolated argument for it. But I just don't see a case for it. And I like Eddie Guerrero an awful lot. He's a guy I would consider for, you know, a top 10 or top 15 all time. But there are a lot of guys who kind of fall into that category where Yeah, I get that they're somebody's favorite, or that they, or somebody grew up with them, or somebody's favorite matches involved them. But I just see, I don't see how they have the combination of versatility, volume, consistency, ability to change themselves, great matches with a variety of wrestlers. I just don't see how they have all of that. You could maybe point to isolated things that they have, and you could maybe argue that their mechanics are better. But I, you know, mechanics alone don't make a wrestler great. You know, if mechanics alone made you a great wrestler, Alex Porteau would have been one of the greatest wrestlers of all time. So,
and if we were arguing mechanics for Lawler, I would have said, "Look at the punch," and that would have been the entire sentence and the entire conversation right there. Look at his punch. Can anyone punch better than him? Save for maybe Terry Funk. But, you know, the point stands that with Lawler, it's not about mechanics ever. You know?
I really do. I mean, this is going to sound so snobby, and I'm going to apologize in advance for saying it, but I'm going to say it anyway. I really think, like, with Bret Hart specifically, the advocates for Bret Hart typically are people who watch the WWF, were used to seeing kind of, you know, average or poor main events. And then there was a guy in the main event pitcher who could work. And he started having better main events than in years past. And I give him all the credit in the world for that, because I think having good matches in the WWF on top was not something that was a regular occurrence. And you could usually count on Bret to deliver on the big shows. So so I don't want to take that away from him. But that definitely
especially without a lot of quality of opposition.
Right, right. Yeah, yeah. And Bret, I mean, he wasn't always against someone else who was good. And I think he put a lot of thought into the matches that he wanted to have on big shows. So I do give him credit for that. But what I think sometimes proponents of Bret Hart miss is that usually when we're having these conversations, we're having them on a global scale. We're not just talking about the best in a promotion or the best in a style. We're trying to find someone who can kind of transcend that. And I don't know that Bret ever really transcended that. What he did is he rose to the top of the style. He probably elevated the people around him. He probably elevated their game a little bit. But did he do something that was like a higher standard to a point where, like, you know, New Japan, for example, like, you know, I mean, New Japan was kind of the bastard child as far as their heavyweights of main events during the same time that Bret was on top. And I'm not quite sure that WWF main events from the mid-90s were better than New Japan main events in the mid-90s. I guess that's one way to put it.
Yeah.
Where someone like Hashimoto could rate very favorably against Hart, you know?
Yes. Yeah, I totally agree with that. I think Hashimoto is a better wrestler than Bret Hart. And I like Bret Hart. I'm not a guy who doesn't think he's good at all, you know? It's not like a guy like Shawn Michaels, who I think was good for a while and then got not very good. You know, although I do think both guys benefit from marketing. You know, I don't care. I'll be the mean guy, and I'll be the one who says it. You know, if the last game in town tells you over and over again that this guy was really great. I mean, in Bret's case, he wasn't the last game in town at the time, but his whole gimmick was that he was a great wrestler. That was literally
his
gimmick.
No, the best there was.
Yeah.
I mean, the best of the past, present, and future.
I mean, yeah, his gimmick was the best wrestler. That was his gimmick. And you know, with Shawn Michaels, his gimmick basically, especially since he's come back, and really since 96, I would argue, has basically been guy who has great matches. That's his gimmick. I mean, and we can argue until we're blue in the face whether the matches are great or not, but I think it's naive to pretend that being booked that way and being promoted that way doesn't help you in the even among supposedly smart fans. We all get worked, period. Like, you know, we all do. And I think it's insane for people to pretend that Shawn Michaels' reputation doesn't have a lot to do with the fact that the WWE has promoted him as the best wrestler. That's why he's
Well, I'm actually going to stick up for that, because two of the three guys we're talking about, Ric Flair was the man. To be the man, you have to beat the man. That was promoted, you know what I mean? And Jerry Lawler, the King of Memphis, sold out the Coliseum more than Elvis. You know, I mean, these are like marketing promotions, you know. So, like you said, but it exists for our guys too. And maybe that's even more impressive, is that Funk never had that label and still is in this conversation.
Yeah, but one difference I would note is that it does exist for the guys we're talking about, but and I do think this is a difference, a big enough difference to note. It does exist for the guys we're talking about as well. However, they did not, it was in their instance, it was, even if it was the promotion, it was Lawler who was behind the booking that promotion. It was Lawler who did that. It was Lawler who was able to talk it up. Lawler who was able to sell it week to week. Same thing with Flair. In the case of Michaels, it's the last major promotion in town, and it's being sold by the last promotion where nobody could possibly dissent. There's no other game in town. They're being beat over the head. The guys that control history are telling you this. It's pretend that George Washington was a good military leader. He actually wasn't. That's sort of the narrative was that, well, George Washington had to be a great military leader because, you know, he saved us from the evil British. Well, that's not really how it was, but that's how the narrative is in your school books when you're creating a national myth. I don't even say this...
Because Americans are crazy.
Well, that's true, too. But I don't even say this totally to shit on Michaels because you could apply this to other people. My point is that there are things beyond just what goes on in the ring that help certain guys who I think have reputations. I mean, you can't. It's not just what happens bell to bell that helps some of these people.
Or how about this one? Sting, the icon of WCW.
Yeah. You know, Will, I would like for you to, just because I think this is something that I haven't read it in a long time, but I'm sure it's still being said sometimes about Lawler, and I think this is something that's worth, like, rebuking once and for all, which is the point of view that Lawler was just like Hogan. I mean, he was just, you know, really a limited wrestler. He just had some punches and a pile driver. And so it's not fair to call him a great wrestler. He could work a crowd, but so could Hogan. I mean, you were hearing stuff like that in a while, that his act was all shtick and not really, like, talent. And I wondered if you could just kind of, like, you know, just kill that once and for all.
Okay, before I do that, I have to preface this by saying, look, in Bret Hart's book, he said that Lawler and Memphis wrestling was joke wrestling. He went there to take a break, right, that it wasn't real, this hokey shit. In the same book, he shits on Flair, saying Flair, he couldn't understand why Flair was the man. And in the same book, he praises Terry Funk. That disqualifies Terry Funk from the conversation right there. Case over. All right. So this has now become a Lawler-Flair conversation. Just wanted to get that out there. Okay.
I would like to point out that Jerry Lawler said he thinks the greatest wrestler of all time is Terry Funk.
Yeah. But he also said that he couldn't draw flies with them, so, you know, what does that mean? Anyway, right? Yeah. It's kind of hard to draw when you have an empty arena match. Anyway, but, okay, well, the reason we do things like the Death Valley Driver 1980s project, the reason we do 90s yearbook projects, is to look at these things that wrestlers, that wrestling insiders, that people have considered, like we were talking earlier, how it was just like known that Flair was the greatest. But anytime you try to refute that, you know, you're seen as contrarian or revisionist or whatever. It's like, no, it's like we actually watched the footage. If Lawler needed to get on the mat with Nick Bockwinkle, not Mick Foley, but Nick Bockwinkle, he could do it. If he needed to bleed, he could do it. If he needed a brawl, he would do it. You know, if he needed a Hulk up, he would do it. If he needed to play underneath because a monster like Kamala or Blackwell or somebody was there beating the hell out of him, he could play Ricky Morton. You know, so if you actually watch the footage, then you know that that's just myth. Okay? That's the best way to refute it, is watch the footage. It's not true, you know? He could make a guy like Bill Dundee, who is 5 foot fucking six, it would be a midget in any major territory and make him Lawler's equal in stature. Now, and does anyone dispute anything I've said so far?
No.
You know, and that's why I think it's hard to make that case with Lawler, because while it's been a standard to say that Flair is the greatest, it's been a standard to say that, like you said, Lawler is a joke, you know? But Lawler, as a wrestler, didn't just recognize, you know, his limitations or his skills. He also recognized the strengths of his opponents or what he needed to do to build his opponent up. He knew that nobody seriously would take Bill Dundee seriously against him, right, if it was just about who's the stronger guy, right? So not every Bill Dundee match is going to be just Lawler pounding on Dundee, because a lot of the times Dundee was the heel. It was Dundee going toe-to-toe with Lawler, getting the best of Lawler, and Lawler allows that, you know. Lawler knew that if he was going to retain the belt week in and week out, even with the Monsters, he had to eventually beat the Monsters. He had to vanquish Kamala. He had to vanquish King Kong Bundy eventually, you know. And while I would say that he wasn't always, like you said, the most proficient at technical moves or innovation, he always knew what his opponent was, like Kerry Von Erich, like I mentioned that earlier. He knew that Kerry Von Erich was a drug-addicted, one-footed, broken man, you know? And that's not even like hyperbole. That's just kind of fact. And
might be understating it.
Yeah, and so Lawler knew, you know, it's Super Clash. If you watch it, I think that's a great match.
Yep.
But it's almost entirely because Lawler is shaping that match, you know? So I think that's Lawler's greatest strength, is understanding his opponent. In fact, it's something like when Lawler wrestles Bockwinkle or Flair as local, you know, hero, you never once think Lawler is beneath this guy. Not once do you ever think, like when Flair wrestles Coco Beware and has a great match, you know Coco's beneath Flair. There's not even a debate. You never get the feeling that Flair is head and shoulders above Lawler, or that Bockwinkle is head and shoulders above Lawler. You know, you never get that feeling. And I think that people need to recognize that. And that's kind of the power of Lawler. And it's one of the reasons I love him so much, because it doesn't matter who his opponent is. If Lawler's the opponent, I'm going to say, what can Lawler do with this guy? And that's something that Flair's been criticized for. And this is what I want you to kind of, you know, debunk this myth, Charles. This people have criticized Flair for years of having his match where if he's wrestling Rick Martel, it's Flair's match. If he's wrestling Nikita Koloff or Jimmy Garvin or Ron Garvin or Magnum TA or Dusty Rhodes, it's Flair's match, and that's why he's able to carry a broomstick to a 3-star match, which I don't agree with that either. But you've heard that levied against Flair, am I right?
Yes. Yes, I have.
So I want you to kind of dispel that.
Please.
So, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Well, what I would say to that is that I'm not going to deny that Ric Flair has a formula. He definitely did. And I think, you see it a lot more when he's wrestling more limited guys. But at the same time, first of all, I don't see why it's a bad thing to have a formula.
For
example, we talk sometimes about, I've mentioned a few times, Flair, I think, getting singled out for things that everyone does. And one of those things is being repetitive, because I feel like every wrestler has signature spots, signature bumps. It seems like it's a common thing. I will say that sometimes maybe Flair's signature things stand out a little bit more, because a lot of his signature stuff is not signature offense, it's signature selling or signature bumping. So it's kind of, I don't know if you want to call it business exposing or what, but so I can see that portion of the criticism. But the idea that he worked the same match is not something that I really get at all, because I think that he's being accused of something that everyone does to an extent. And I don't really know what it is that people wanted him to do that he wasn't doing. You know, Ric Flair versus Lex Luger and Ric Flair versus Ricky Morton, they're not going to be the same match. Flair's going to pull out some of the same offense, but they're not going to be the same match. Ric Flair against Barry Windham and Ric Flair against Kabuki in All Japan, they're not going to be the same match again. It's one thing to say that Ric Flair has a formula, but it's another thing to say that formula is somehow a negative. That's the part of it that I've never really understood.
formula was so bad, how come there's so many good Southern tag matches?
Right, right. And that's,
Southern tag match is a match you could take four guys that suck and have a good Southern tag match. I mean, yeah, very easily. Like
the Southern tag has produced more good matches. I'm sorry.
Yeah. No, go ahead, Charles.
I was just going to say the Southern tag has produced more good matches than any idea in the history of wrestling.
Oh, easily. I don't even think it's close. Because you can take four guys with little to no talent and have a good Southern tag match. Very easily, just by laying out, working within the confines of your structure, and having one or two memorable spots. That's all you really need. Flair's formula, I think, at times got a little bit out of hand. You can watch matches where it got a little bit out of hand. But having said that, watching all this stuff for the 80s projects, and even watching WCW 90s footage a few years back for the Smart Choice poll, I actually was struck by how little Flair was the same, you know, match to match. I actually think that is an extremely overrated talking point.
Agreed.
There's no question that he has a formula, but I think formula is what you need in wrestling. In fact, anybody who says formula in wrestling is a bad thing, or that it doesn't work, or that it's stale, or whatever, what in the hell is wrestling psychology based on if not guys trying to combat other people's formulas? that's basically what wrestling psychology is. I mean, that's not all it is, but that's a huge, huge portion of it. You couldn't even have psychology as we know it in wrestling, which everybody claims to love, if you didn't have some sort of formulas that were consistent. So it was a bit of a tangent, but that really pisses me off because I hate that argument. I hate the formulas are stale, tired, worn out, innovation above all stuff. I think that's a totally insane way of looking at anything, let alone wrestling. I just don't understand why anybody would have that perspective. I mean, I get that there are going to be people who like innovative stuff more than me, and that's okay. But to say that formula is bad and innovation is good in all instances, I think, and there are people who literally will tell you that, I think is just totally asinine. I just can't imagine why anybody would believe that.
I also think with Flair, it really doesn't pay attention to the subtleties that he brings into it, too.
True. Very true. Yeah.
No, but
he was a very good at getting across subtleties. I don't think there's any question about that.
Dylan, as somebody who's watched more Terry Funk than probably anybody, you, okay, why don't you try to kind of explain why Terry Funk, quote-unquote garbage wrestler from ECW onward to the end of his career, isn't really fair to Terry Funk? Because, I mean, if we're talking longevity, people are going to say, well, just Terry Funk threw some garbage cans around. Why is that kind of a misconception?
Well, first of all, two things, because I don't know, you know, we're already running later on time, and I want to get all this in, so I'll just cover all this real quick.
Okay.
What I do, one criticism I think it is legitimate to say that Terry Funk's best style was brawling. I don't think, you know, if you had to break it down to specifics, mat wrestler, brawling, you know, more fast-paced, spotty guys. If you were looking at, you know, trying to break it down to any subcategory you wanted to, I think at the end of the day, it's pretty clear that Terry Funk's best category is as a brawler. Having said that, what I think is really incredible about Funk is that I think he is maybe at his absolute peak. He might be the absolute best babyface I've ever seen, and the absolute best heel I've ever seen. 1989, Terry Funk as a heel was really outstanding. And it might be my all-time favorite heel run. Late 1970s, early 1980s in All Japan, Terry Funk, I really honestly think is probably the best babyface run I've ever seen in terms of piecing together comebacks, timing, selling, bumping. He was a master at the big bumps. You know, when he broke out a big bump in All Japan, it meant something, and it was going to mean something in the context of the match. And when he did his little hop around dance comeback when he was throwing his punches, you knew the crowd was... I mean, this guy had cheerleaders. Literally, that was one of my favorite things about, you know, watching the All Japan footage. Just Terry Funk has got literal cheerleaders in the crowd for him. But I think the narrative of Funk as a great brawler is not one that I would even distance myself from. What I would distance myself from is the narrative of Funk as a garbage wrestler. Because even if you wanted to say, well, look, Funk's absolute best stuff that we have on tape is overwhelmingly brawls, I think that's a fair point. But they're not the same kind of brawls. There's a big difference between a death match with Onita and the sort of tag team matches that he was working with his brother against, you know, Gordy and Hanson, or the way he was working versus, say, Tommy Rich in 1997 in the ECW arena. I mean, there's a big, big difference between all of those matches. Some of them are your out-of-control sort of running around with weapons brawls. Some of them are straight matches that escalate into fistfights, which I think Funk was really excellent at. Some of them are your blood feud rivalry type stuff. Some of them are almost comedic, if not outright comedic. But they're all different within the context of a brawling viewpoint. I mean, another guy who I love is Stan Hansen. Stan Hansen's probably my top 10 all time. You know, he's a guy that I would put just below the guys we're talking about tonight. And Hansen is a guy that I think is pretty much universally a brawler. But he was good at working holds when he needed to. He was good at getting over big spots when he needed to. He was a great tag wrestler, as was Terry Funk. So even if you were to say, yes, this is Terry's biggest strength, I don't think it is to say that it is, A, his only strength, B, nor do I think that's an immediate disqualifier. Because as Will mentioned earlier, brawls are his favorite type of wrestling. They're pretty much mine. And it's not like we don't have something like Funk versus Jumbo we can point to and say, boy, this guy could do this really well too. We have it. We know it exists. Maybe we don't have enough of it to make a case that he's an all-time great in that style. But that's mainly because of what we have peak-wise on foot in terms of footage. I don't think it's because the stuff doesn't exist. Because if you look at the snippets that we have of him working holds and working more traditional style matches, he looks great all the time, you know. And one other thing I would really point out with Funk, too, is when you put him in a match, when you tell Terry Funk, you got 10 minutes, you got a fucking Lanny Poffo for 10 minutes, or you got Ricky Santana for 10 minutes, a lot of guys would just say, okay, I'm going to eat this guy alive, and or Eddie Guerrero in 1989, you know, or maybe even better example. I'm going to eat this guy alive. I might let him get in a couple of high spots so I could sort of do my over-the-top traditional heel bumping, but basically it's going to be a forgettable match, and then that's going to be the finish. Even a lot of great wrestlers would do that. Not Terry Funk. You know, there is no boring Terry Funk match. I've never seen it. You know, I mean, well, I guess Will would say the Dory Funk draw, but if you set aside that, there's no boring Terry Funk match. I mean, if you give him 5-10 minutes with Ricky Santana or Eddie Guerrero when Eddie was really, really green, or Scott Hall or Lanny Poffo or old-ass Mr. Wrestling 2 or old-ass Pedro Morales, you were probably going to get an entertaining 10 minutes. I mean, yep. You weren't going to get some boring waste of time. He did never, ever did that. And a lot of those matches are not brawls either. I mean, the Lanny Poffo match is a super entertaining match, and it's not a brawl. You know, so Funk is, even if people wanted to argue that he's a one-trick pony, I think he's arguably the best at that trick, and I think that ignores so many other things, like how great of a baby face he was, because it's one thing to say Terry Funk is a great, you know, was a great brawling crazy man heel. It's another thing to realize Terry Funk was unbelievably great as the Ricky Morton guy getting stabbed to death by Abdullah the Butcher. You know, those aren't the same thing. You know, even if the match types are similar, his role is so drastically different that it represents a difference in kind. Filibuster over.
I would also say,
hold on.
Funk's baby face stuff in All Japan could possibly be his best work, but even if you take that out of the equation, like some people who might not even know about it, he's probably still in the running.
Yeah, I don't disagree with that.
Dave, can I just mention something? The reason I asked Dylan that question is I knew he would speak long enough for me to be able to eat my pizza. So, full disclosure, I had a fucking few slices of pizza there I wanted to kill off. And I was like, okay, I'm defending Lawler while the pizza cools down. Okay. I'm going to ask Charles a question so I can cut the slices. And now I want to eat this shit. So I'm going to ask Dylan a question to make sure I get to eat my pizza. And it worked, man. Thank you.
One other real quick thing I want to mention about Funk that has not been mentioned, and I do want to mention it, is Terry Funk was the first indie wrestling superstar, the guy that really was like your guy touring around the indies, elevating guys on the indies, being almost a weird like superstar presence within the indie scene. I think it really comes off that way if you do watch Will's Terry Funk set. But that's something that I don't think really gets mentioned either when you talk about things that he did that were interesting and outside the purview of what we, you know, are new, are fresh, I guess, in wrestling. Terry Funk, that's just another area where he was, and that it wasn't that I think it was tough to do because these were lots of times not really established territories at all, not established promotions, didn't necessarily know what you had to bring to engage those fans, and Funk always brought it. Even into the 2000s with the CM Punk match or with the matches versus Lawler that took place or even with the Dusty matches that took place in the 2000s, Funk always knew what to bring even in those indie settings.
Yeah. I mean, I agree with all that.
Yeah. Here's one measure we can always go by too, guys. So if all of the history of professional wrestling was to be wiped out, except for the matches of one guy, which of these three guys do you think should we keep their stuff?
Well, duh, Lawler. Yeah, is there even another choice? Oh, wait, wrong show. Shit. Yeah. No, I mean...
I mean, if you're asking me who I would rather watch, the answer is Terry Funk. If you're asking me who I think is the most historically significant, the answer is Ric Flair. And I don't think there's a case for any of the other two. Even if we had Terry Funk's NWA title run, I don't think there's a case for any of the other two. Dylan, hold on.
If we're asking who I'd rather watch, it'd be Jerry Lawler. If we're asking who's the most historically significant in Memphis, it's Jerry Lawler. I just had to throw that out there. Man. I'm not going to let that go.
No, I mean, look, I think if when you're talking, Flair is a bigger star. I don't think there's any question than the other two.
Yeah.
But, so that's a tough question to answer for me. Because if you're looking at it from a preservationist standpoint, I think you have to go with Flair because there's naturally going to be more history wrapped up in Flair. Especially if you're looking at the broad picture preservationist and not specific to individual territories or promotions. But if it's who would you rather watch, for me it's Terry Funk because I know I'm never going to see boring or bad Terry Funk. That's the thing. I'm never going to get sick of him. Even now, after a 50-disc set, and after watching all this stuff, there are still matches I stumble upon. A few months back, I'm watching 80s WWF. I'm like, Terry Funk versus Scott McGee? What the hell? I watch it. Sure enough, match is good as shit. You know, that's just consistent with him, and it's probably never going to change.
Charles, is it safe to say that yours is Flair?
It is Flair, and the reason for that is, I mean, the historical factor is one thing I was already thinking of, and that's definitely valid. But for me personally, just in terms of personal taste, I think Ric Flair, more than anyone, really represents what wrestling can be when it's really great. And that's encompassing everything, not just the bell-to-bell work, but just the entire presentation of wanting to see a match, getting hyped up to see the match, watching the match, loving the match, just like everything from start to finish. I see Ric Flair as like the living embodiment of that.
See, and I'm going to say that to me, if we're not just talking bell to bell, if we're talking everything, the promos leading to the match, if we're talking about the angles after the match, if we're talking about seeing somebody get their comeuppance, to me, that's Jerry Lawler in a landslide. And that's something I know we're running long, but I really wanted to bring this topic up. Dave, sorry to take your role as moderator, but I really do because I'm interested to hear like, if we're, because we're making this argument about who they are as wrestlers and their strengths and weaknesses, but, like, they all had memorable feuds, correct? I mean, all of them, okay?
Yes.
But, like, maybe just to do a list of mania or something, like, I think it would be cool if each of us went by and said, okay, if you want to watch Terry Funk, watch these feuds, because Lawler has memorable feuds, Flair has memorable feuds that we can point to, Funk has the memorable feuds. Like, what would you tell people, not necessarily just matches, because, you know, matches, you know, like, one man's number one is another guy's number 10, but kind of like the feuds that encompass all those things, Charles, from start to finish, the angle, the matches, the aftermath, the payoff. What would you tell people to watch?
For Terry Funk, I would say Ric Flair and Jerry Lawler, actually, but for... For Ric Flair.
I'll just say this now so you can even skip over me. I agree with that, and I would just throw in anything where Terry Funk is opposing Stan Hansen on the other side.
That's excellent. Is that your whole answer, though, Dylan? Because I wanted both of y'all to elaborate on that, because I kind of want to elaborate on Ballers.
Well, I'll go into it more, but Charles, go ahead.
Okay. Yeah. For Flair, I would actually say the Ric Flair-Ricky Morton feud, just because I've always hated the idea that people should watch Flair Steamboat without, you know, when they're going back and watching all that stuff for the first time, because you have these two stoic performers walking up in this environment that doesn't really reflect who they are all the time. Where to me, Ric Flair versus Ricky Morton captures who Ric Flair is most of the time, for most of his career. If he's a heel, that's the guy he is. So that would be the first feud I would say. Another I would say would be Ric Flair versus Lex Luger. And they're not the best matches of his career, but to me, there was a chemistry there between those two that, I mean, Flair had better matches with other people in some cases, although there aren't, it's not a long list, but there's a chemistry between Flair and Luger where, I mean, they really pushed at the time that Luger was going to be the successor to the throne, and it worked really well. And I think just, I mean, they had a long run of pay-per-view matches. I thought the angle was good where Luger split from the Horsemen. You know, it was a title chase that was kind of built up and never paid off, so there is that downside to it. But those are the two feuds I'd probably pick, Ricky Morton and Lex Luger.
Yeah, you know, if you're looking at, I mean, absolute peak feuds, I agree with Charles that it's actually the Flair and Lawler feuds. I think, and I don't think that's surprising that the best guys have the best stuff with each other. I will say that I think Lawler is in a disadvantage Funk is in a disadvantage in this sense, because never being an ace of a promotion, when the promotion isn't run around you the same way as it is other guys, your feuds are not necessarily going to immediately jump off the page the way others are, because he was the guy that was being brought in to feud with people as opposed to being the guy that was having challengers thrown at him. Having said that, outside of those two, I think anything with Funk versus Hansen is worth watching from any time period, any time they clash, whether it's tags, singles, whatever. Because the matches are always good, and it really gets across. Funk is such a great underdog. We tend to look at Funk as this crazy Texan roughneck. Well, guess what? Hansen's just as crazy and even rougher. And Funk has no problem falling back almost into this docile babyface. I mean, that one match is so great where he keeps going for the spinning toe hold, and it's like that ends up being the death of him. You know, that ends up getting him split open, getting him choked out, and getting him beat to hell. So the Hansen stuff, I think, really is a great look at Funk as a babyface and an interesting babyface, working against a guy who, in a lot of ways, was like him, I guess. The other thing that I would point out for Funk, and this is going to be kind of a strange one, because I don't think as highly of the matches relative to the Hansen feud, is Sabu. Because I'm not a super huge Sabu fan by any stretch of the imagination. But Funk would have these matches with Sabu on small little promotions, and there's a couple of them on the Funk set, and also matches with Sabu, obviously, in ECW that are more well-known, Born to be Wire being the most obvious one. And these guys would go out and have sort of the style of match that would set the table for what ECW would become. And they were doing it on small spot shows, small house shows, for tiny little promotions in California and the Midwest. And that sort of gives you a good look at funk as the trailblazer for this sort of modern indie style in a lot of ways. And, you know, it's not a feud that a lot of people would talk about. It's not his best feud, but I think it's an interesting feud. And it's a run of matches that is much better than you would expect. I mean, there's at least two matches those guys have that I think are outstanding, and another that actually, you know, is on the ECW set that is shockingly great. It's from 97, you know, years later when Funk had the title. So, yeah, that would be sort of my dark horse pick for Terry Funk feuds.
Yeah, I wasn't expecting that at all. That's kind of what I was hoping to get out of you, something like that for people to turn to. You know,
I think one that people would recognize a lot too is him and his work with Foley.
Yes. Yeah. Absolutely.
Right. No. Yeah. Yeah. That's true. But I don't know if even that's either guy's best stuff, to be honest with you. So I wouldn't point to the Foley. Would you point to the Foley feud? I wouldn't. I mean,
I think there are aspects of the feud that are psychologically really interesting, but I don't think it's an apex feud for either guy. I do think those guys are synonymous with each other in the minds of a lot of people for a lot of reasons. So I think it's one of those things where you're naturally drawn to mention Mick Foley in the same breath as Terry Funk. Even I am, you know. But I don't think their best stuff was with each other, although you maybe could argue that some of their best promos were with each other.
That's a good point. Well,
yeah,
I want to bring up
with each other, not necessarily all their in-ring stuff. But.
Yeah.
I want to bring up Jerry Lawler, and the easy answer, just like Loss with Flair, is Flair Steamboat. The easy answer is Lawler Dundee. But those two guys, even more so than Flair Steamboat, because you could easily say Steamboat is synonymous with Randy Savage, right? You know, or Flair is synonymous with Sting, you know, I mean, just for some, you know. But Lawler Dundee really is Memphis wrestling, you know, for not just one decade, but for three decades. And they're still doing, like, matches against each other in the 2000s, you know. So everybody should experience the Lawler Dundee feud. But a couple of ones I want to touch on are the Dutch Mantel feud in 1982.
Excellent feud.
Just from an in-ring quality spectacle standpoint, angle, payoff, everything, just top to bottom, great feud. And, you know, Charles asked about, you know, can you point to Lawler as the best in the world in a year? And I said 1982 is one of them. Later on that year, the feud with Nick Bockwinkel. When we did the voting for the Memphis set, I didn't even have any of these matches very high because I was very down on Nick Bockwinkel from All Japan because I'd watched a lot of Bockwinkel's All Japan stuff earlier. But after I started working on the AWA set, I went and rewatched the Bockwinkel stuff. And this just reinforces what I said earlier. Not at one point, even though Bockwinkel tried to sell you that Lawler was beneath him because he was just some local yokel from the Hicks in Tennessee, not at one point did Lawler ever feel like the lesser wrestler in that. And that's a credit to both guys as being, like, true great wrestlers. You know, not at one point did you feel like you got ripped off. You know, and then the payoffs were there in the match. You know, the matches, you know, the matches didn't all end cleanly, but you felt like at the end of it, wow, I just saw a really special feud. And then I want to kind of go to the 90s because these two feuds probably didn't produce any of Jerry Lawler's greatest matches. And Loss knows which one, or Charles knows which ones I'm talking about. And these are the Snowman feud from 1990, because Charles will tell you probably the feud of the year in 1990 of any promotion didn't produce one great match except for like a sub-4-minute shoot fight that you couldn't really tell if they were kidding or if they were really hating each other. And it was almost all angle driven and clips from the Mid-South Coliseum. And just from those clips the interviews and the angles in the studio, you got the feel that this is one of the greatest feuds you'll see from start to finish. And the other one is the USWA Memphis versus WWF feud, where Lawler was a face in Memphis saying all of these roided up guys in WWF, it's not real wrestling. That's why I go up there. That's why I heckle their fans, because they don't know what we have here. And then turns around in WWF and becomes this heel, this annoying, shut the fuck up already heel. And it works in both places. And it just shows you how masterful he is at controlling people, you know. And I really wanted to bring those up as like kind of the non-work rate master storyteller Lawler, to where you have the Dundee, Mantell, Bockwinkel series where it's all work rate, you know, where every one of those matches is like upper echelon, high work rate classic stuff.
And yeah. Will, I would also argue that Eddie Gilbert had the booking and the matches, the match quality. So, I mean, that's to me one of his best feuds too.
Excellent. Yeah, no, that's true too. I mean, he got ran over by a fucking car, and it lasted a decade, right? The Eddie Gilbert feud lasted a decade, you know? Eddie Gilbert come in, be a thorn in Lawler's side, pop out, come back, run over him, pop out, come back, be his tag partner, even though he hates him. I mean, just fucking, no, you're right. Eddie Gilbert's a great feud too. I mean,
one of Funk's great feuds too, actually, with Eddie Gilbert. I mean, their stuff on the indies in the early 90s was really good. And they were able to take on indie shows with no TV, where people didn't even know the issue, and have basically blood feud matches that were entirely believable and compelling. You know, so, I would agree wholeheartedly, and I haven't even seen all the stuff that you guys have seen from Memphis during that period. With the Gilbert pick, you know, so not going to see me argue again. The idea of arguing against any of these guys, I think, is silly, really, because they're all, any one of these three is a perfectly viable greatest of all time pick. I don't. It's not a contentious or controversial statement to me on any level for any one of these three, to be somebody's number one. I don't think it's a weird or eccentric statement, obviously. And I think all of them are guys who you can point to matches, you can point to feuds, you can point to angles, you can point to runs, you can point to long periods. You know, I mean, if I had to say, and I guess I'll do this, I'll kind of wrap up on my end. If I had to make a hard pitch for Terry Funk and why I absolutely would put him number one, it is, A, the fact that you never get sick of. He never I think that's a huge, huge plus in wrestling, especially for people like us who watch so much. To have a guy who you never get sick of and you can keep finding good matches from, even now after you thought you'd seen everything, is a major, major plus. I'm not even saying it's unique to Funk in this discussion, but it's a major, major plus for him as the greatest of all time candidate. And one thing that I would push probably maybe even harder than that is his versatility. You know, he could work the mat. He was an excellent Ricky Morton style babyface. He was an excellent bruising brawler. He was an excellent, pretty much any position you put him in against any wrestler for, you know, 40 years. But maybe the single biggest case I make for Terry Funk is at his absolute peak as a babyface and as a heel, I think he might be the best I've ever seen at either role. And yes, you could argue that his absolute peak as a heel wasn't terribly long, maybe, and you perhaps could argue that his absolute peak as a babyface in All Japan wasn't super long, although I think it was actually fairly long. But that really stands out because he was so, so good at both. I realize the same could be applied. A lot of these arguments could be applied to both these other guys. But that would sort of be my three-pronged argument for Terry Funk.
Dylan, I just want to, just popped in my head. You could argue that Terry Funk is the one-night stand. Jerry Lawler is the woman you're married to for life from high school until death. And Ric Flair is the guy with three wives all over the country. I'm just saying.
You literally could argue all those things, I think, actually.
Yes.
I'm pretty sure they're actually true. Clearly.
They are actually true. But yeah. Do either one of you guys want to add anything else, or do you want to make your final conclusion?
Yeah, this is the hard sell guide.
I think for Ric Flair, the last thing I would say is just that the reason I consider him the best ever is that he, to me, from 1982 to 1989, had the best 8 years that any wrestler has ever had in the history of recorded footage. So that would be what I would point to above all else, just seeing a guy go from place to place, from opponent to opponent, and have that high quality of a run that lasted that long, which you know, we talked about longevity before. To me, the way I define longevity in this context is being, like, you know, best in the world for that length of time. So somebody can do that has my pick for best of all time. And that's not in any way a slight against Terry Funk or Jerry Lawler. It's just it's why I think Flair's got it.
Well, my argument for Lawler would be, you know, because he stayed in one place so long, because he was Mr. Consistent, the ability for at least, 15 years, and I'm sure some historian will bear this out, of being the absolute man on top, and for a good 20 years of being Mr. Memphis through good and bad, for him to still be able to sell tickets week after week for that long when everybody else, Devon Erickson in Texas, JYD in New Orleans, you know, Tommy Rich in Georgia, whoever you want to say embodies whatever territory, even Buddy Rose in Portland, who I love Buddy Rose, you know, those guys all withered away. Their companies withered away. And Lawler, whether it was through Jarrett's, you know, frugal demeanor, whatever, Lawler stayed Mr. Memphis through all those years, and he still put on great matches, and he still had memorable angles and had memorable promos and had the people in the palm of his hand. And when he did turn heel, it was a huge deal, and it always felt logical and reasonable when he did it. And when it was time to become a face, he was a face, and the people embraced him all over. And I never felt like the fans just got tired of him. Maybe the ticket sales say otherwise, but I never felt that way. And to this day, just, I get excited, you know, about seeing new Jerry Lawler matches. And to be fair, I get excited about seeing new Flair and Funk matches too. But for me, it's like, I kind of know that if Ric Flair is wrestling somebody, I still feel like I know what I'm getting into. With Terry Funk, depending on where he's wrestling at, I kind of feel like I know it. Like, if I know if he's in ECW, I'm going to get a certain type of Terry Funk. If I see Terry Funk in All Japan, I'm going to get another type of Terry Funk. With Jerry Lawler, it's always like opening a new present at Christmas time for me. It really is. It's like I don't know which Lawler I'm going to get, what his opponent's going to bring to the table, how he's going to make this opponent credible. I don't know any of those things. And to me, that's the greatness of Lawler, and you know, and I'm really happy, guys, that we had this conversation, because it kind of proves that we can have three diverse opinions of three great wrestlers, and we're very strong about our opinions, and kind of give a blueprint on how you can argue your points without being an asshole. And I think that really should be said.
And it also proves it also proves that Dave is the king of inappropriate jokes. I think we can all.
I was trying to dethrone him, man. I mean, y'all didn't get the death by weight machine. I mean,
I think it absolutely proves that. I do want to.
He choked on that one, Will. Sorry.
One really quick thing, and then I want to pitch to Dave for his final thought. I would note that if we were talking absolute peak, I feel compelled to say this, especially because Will's on the phone. If we were talking absolute peak, the best, like, a guy who I think was the absolute best at his absolute height, I honestly think is Buddy Rose. I honestly think at his absolute best, all things into account, mechanics, versatility, the little things in wrestling, selling, bumping, stooging, having good matches against a bunch of scrubs, because he didn't have a Dundee. He didn't have a Steamboat. He didn't have a Terry Funk. He didn't have, his guys were Rip Oliver and fucking, I mean, he, like, he to me, is at his absolute pinnacle is the best wrestler I've ever seen. It's just his pinnacle wasn't long enough, and he doesn't have that big arena setting that really leaves you with that lasting impression. But I did want to say that, because I even though he's not been the focus of the conversation, there's no way I could skip over that. And we will do a show on Buddy Rose eventually. There's no question about that, because
I better be in that conversation, because I can't.
I would love to have you on, and my brother. I'd love to have Devin on for that too. But
And I've got the set now, so.
I'm telling you. And there'll be another four-person roundtable on the greatness of Buddy Rose. But, Dave, final thoughts, comments?
Terry Funk did the most as far as different places doing completely unique things that were just amazing. Lawler is easily the best hometown wrestler of all time, to the point where everybody should study him. Charles, your point about Flair's peak in that 8-year period, you know, I would say just as far as what pro wrestling is supposed to be, that really is kind of exactly what a pro wrestler should be. So based on their body of work and this debate, I'm going to change my previous pick and go with Ric Flair.
Nice. Charles.
And you know what? I can't fault anybody for doing that.
But you know what? I can say that since Dave's a Canadian, it's extra special, because to have to pick Ric Flair when Bret Hart is right there, I know it has to be rough.
Dude,
and you know,
to have to pick Ric Flair when Bobby Bass is right there.
Yeah,
oh, man.
This podcast
trust
is going to get a lot of hate mail
from
the Great
White. I definitely
like
Barack Obama better than Stephen Harper, so it's not that too. It's not that.
But yeah, I can't fault anybody for siding with Ric Flair in any debate on any of this stuff. Guys, it was awesome as always. One of these days we will probably have all four of us on the line again. God knows what the hell we'll be talking about that time, but I envision it happening again.
Yeah.
Because
Dylan, I want to announce that Charles and I have been talking, and we're actually looking to set it up. We don't know if we're going to do Talk Show. We don't know if we're just going to do like a podcast site where we record it and then put it up on another site. But we're going to do a pro wrestling only radio. It's coming in the future. We're going to have like people from the board on. So that way, if Dave can't make it, you can always pop in on our show. If you can't make it, Dave can pop in to talk about Leo Burke. I mean, we wanted to be inclusive. Other guys up on the board who might have podcasts, if they want to come on and verbally spar with Charles and I, we'll have that. And, you know, it'll be an interesting attempt at trying to revitalize maybe some of that roundtable discussion that maybe happened at DVDVR that kind of disappeared. So, you know, not a new concept, but at the same time, you know, something that I think is sorely lacking right now. And that you and Dave, honestly, right now, ever since Goodwill Wrestling went down, I'm just saying, by far the best podcast out there, quality-wise, entertainment value, helping me get through burning tons of sets, by far. I mean, really.
That's the key. That's the key, because as long as you keep putting out the footage, if we're a motivating factor, I think I speak for both me and Dave, if we can help you burn through and get more stuff out, then we've done our job.
Well, you know what, though? Now, I'm going to give Charles credit here, too. I mean, as we have our big hug fest here, the yearbooks really are Charles' baby. I mean, he's the one who came up with the concept. He's the one who helps me collect footage I don't have, and he's the one who comes up with a large chunk of the match list. So if you enjoy the yearbooks and the ease of watching them, thank Charles.
Absolutely, yeah. And I can't stress this enough, because this is really mushy stuff, you know. But I'll get through it, hopefully without shedding a tear or having a Jodie Foster moment. But honestly, there are a lot of people I talk to about wrestling online, and that I've talked to for years. But my absolute three favorite people to talk to about wrestling with, aside from my brother Devin, who's blood, are the people that are on this phone right now. So,
well, thank you.
And that's not bullshit. That's not me. You know, whatever. That's 100% true. These are my absolute three favorite people to talk to about wrestling for totally different reasons. Funny enough, but it's not even close by a wide, wide, wide margin. And thank you for the kind words about the show.
It's just a fact, man. I mean, on the Wrestling Observer Board, they said that any shitty podcast was the antithesis of what wrestling culture is. So, I mean that's such a great... But, guys, seriously, in all seriousness, this was an excellent conversation, but I have two little kids yelling at me, and I have a wife yelling at me, and it's time to run, and I can't wait to listen to the feedback that the show gets, and I can't wait to listen to the show while I'm working on the 1991 yearbook and getting those orders out. So look for those.
Plug. Lickety split.
My phone's about to go dead like a wrestler from Texas, so I better get it.
Okay. All of the above. Everybody, thank you for listening. Charles, Will, thanks for being on. Dave, as always, thanks for putting up with me and all of
thanks,
us.
Guys.
Thanks for doing the show.
Later, guys.
We will be back soon. God knows with who.
Yeah, thanks, everybody. This was great. This was great. I really enjoyed it.
Me too.
Okay.
Bye.